Let's begin. In a number of the words of the Achronim, Rav Soloveitchik spoke about this. It's already in the words of the Rishonim, if you look carefully. It's clear that Tisha B'Av is a complex day. It is a day both of Tainus and Tshuva on the one hand, but it's also a day of Avelus. The first is hard. The physical Tainus is difficult. It's a long day. Here in Eretz Yisrael, it's a very hot day. Tshuva is always difficult. But I think that of the two dinim, it's clear that the second is even harder. To have genuine avelus, to genuinely mourn the Beis HaMikdash. The problem is both obvious and profound. How do we genuinely, really, in our kishkes, mourn something which we never experienced? How do we feel a sense of loss for something that we never had? A miktsas nechama I can give you, we're not alone and we're not the first. A number of years ago, the great Professor Schneer Lyman published his translation and annotation of a primary source. If I remember correctly, I believe it was from the memoirs of Rav Greenwald, who was a legendary Rav in Posek, eventually immigrating to Columbus. Some of you in the Kolo may be learning Chos Avelus, are familiar with his classic Kolbo al Avelus. Great Talmud Chacham, but he was really a Renaissance man, very eclectic interests, wrote about many things. And in one of his writings, which Professor Lyman translated, he actually recounted the experience on Tisha B'Av in 1870 in the University of Leipzig with two then graduate students, Ignaz Goldseider and Wilhelm Bacher, both of whom eventually, after this period where the story takes place, became significant scholars, Jewish scholars and leaders, the European and particularly the 19th century Hungarian Jewish community. The story is that these graduate students in the University of Leipzig in 1870, and it's Tisha B'Av afternoon, Kinos is done, and they're back in their dorm rooms at the college, at the university, and they had a problem. They were bored. It's Tisha B'Av, what do you do? I remember, they had no movies. There was not even a Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation program. Operation Thunderbolt hadn't been made yet. So what is a Jew to do on Tisha B'Av afternoon? So they were playing chess. It's a very Hamish game. And all was going well until there was a knock at the door. And peering, apparently there was a window door. There was a little pane of glass. And they see peering through was one of their professors and mentors, a famed Protestant theologian, Franz Dillich. Now, as it happens, these two Jewish scholars were very close with Professor Dillich, and they described him as a philo-Semite. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with that term, it is the positive, the opposite of an anti-Semite. I wouldn't call it irrational, but let's say excessive admiration for Jews. Not irrational, we deserve it, but excessive, a philo-Semite. And he was also a big Talmid Chacham. He could read not only Hebrew, he knew Aramaic, he knew Shas. Again, this is before even Hamasifta, let alone Schottenstein. He's a big Talmud Chacham, a scholar, and a philo-Semite. So he's knocking at the door. The two students are embarrassed as they're confronted by their professor, and they quickly push the chessboard and the pieces underneath the bed. Professor walks in, and after a quiet moment, he says to them the following: "Friends, I share in your sorrow, but I ask that you not despair your tragic fate. Ultimately, the dawn will break, the sun will shine forth, and your people too will experience happy days. May the Lord comfort you with all of the other mourners of Israel and Zion." Bowed his head, turned around, and he left the room. In Goldseider's diary, he writes the following: I stared at my friend, and then I said, this Christian actually believes that we Jews spend Tisha B'Av mourning. Figure that. Let that be a lesson to us. And we both sat down on the floor for the rest of the day. The chessboard was never taken out again. And we spent the rest of the afternoon studying the passages in Gittin that discuss the destruction of the temple. And since then, the professor noted, the Jewish professor now at the end of his life, I take great pains each year to commemorate Tisha B'Av appropriately. That's why we're here. That's exactly why we're all here. Not to pass the time that we could do on our own, but to spend the time appropriately, properly. Not just to make it through the fast, but to make sure that the fast makes it through us. And that's not easy. And that's why we're here together, and that's our avoda for the morning. Kinos begin, the first kina known as kina vav, number 6. And I'd like to introduce it now. I have a little bit to say on it. It is the first kina that everyone says, no matter what shul or minyan you're davening in. And in particular, there were a number of very important yesodos that Rav Soloveitchik used to stress every year on this kina, which I'd like to share with you and elaborate on them. So first, in terms of the history and the style of the kina, this is one of the kinos of the famed Rebbe Elazar HaKalir. Stylistically, it is incredibly brilliant and incredibly difficult and complicated kina, one of the most, in my opinion, interweaving words from various chapters of Eicha. It's really unbelievable work of liturgy. But for our purposes, let's focus on a few of the key sections. First, the opening word, the title of the kina, Shabbas. So Shabbas, it literally means to stop or to cease. And if you think about it, there are really, and here I'm amplifying what the Rav used to say, there are two dinim, two different aspects, or two different ways that something can stop, or that the Churban stopped something, the Shabbas. Number one is how it happened, and number two is the impact of the Churban. The first, and this is included in the commentary in the kinos that are in Koren, J.J. Schachter published it in his book as well, the Rav used to stress the Shabbos doesn't just mean stopping, but it means sudden or a shocking stop. The Rav used to quote the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which speaks about the original, the first Shabbos, when Friday turned into the Sabbath, Shabbos, and how it happened on a dime, in an instant, suddenly. But this led the Rav to ask a very obvious question. Hayitachem, is it possible? How could you describe the Churban as Shabbos, as something sudden or shocking, if the Nevi'im had been warning and prophesying about it for years and years? It was anything but sudden or shocking. It was totally, unfortunately, by point, to be expected. Soloveitchik explained that despite the paradoxical nature of this reality, it is in fact reality. That despite the warnings, not only the people, but even the Navi, as is described in Yirmiyahu and Perek Lamed Beis, after he goes on this mission from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to buy some land and he comes back, and even the Navi is surprised when he realizes, when he comes closer to Yerushalayim, that the Churban has taken place. And the Rav said the only way we can understand this is by way of mashal, by analogy, to the death of a loved one. In my experience in the Rabbanus, I saw this a number of times. And the Rav, I don't know if this is in the Koren, published, but many years ago, when I would go to hear Rabbi Schachter at the Jewish Center, I heard him say, based on a tape, that the Rav related this autobiographically to the loss of his own wife. And that is that he had known she was sick, of course, and he had been by her bedside for many, many days in the hospital. But then there was one day where he had to go do a Dvar Mitzvah, something came up, and he left. And when he came back, she had passed away. And he was shocked, utterly shocked. It's the way it is with the death of a loved one, even in those instances when we know it's coming, and on some level we prepare ourselves, the finality of death is still shocking. We know it's coming, but the profound nature of loss is still a shock. That's the first aspect of Shavas. But there's a second. And that is that Shavas means a complete cessation. What was before, the Yom HaShishi, is literally no longer. It doesn't exist. It doesn't ebb away. It's gone for that period afterwards. Shavas means that there was something, not only a building, but a world which exists, and then Shavas, it was gone. Nothing left. A number of years ago, I had the great pleasure, along with my wife to join, and a sister of mine, to join my parents on one of these kosher tours to Costa Rica. You can do that nowadays. And while we were there in San Jose, and anyone who's thinking of traveling, I recommend it, is one of the most magnificent shuls you will see anywhere in the world. Stunning. Huge, compound, complex, more than just a shul, but the shul, everything about it is breathtaking in the modern sense. It's not like going to Europe and seeing the old great shuls. This is newer, but it is great. Perhaps the most inspiring thing that I saw there was in the courtyard or so, in front of the shul, on the floor, there's an incredible inlay on the floor, like a mosaic almost, but it's out of stone. And it's a circular design. And imagine, if you will, it's made up in sections, almost like a pie, like a pizza pie. And on top of each of the sections is the name of the Hebrew months, so there's 12 sections. And then in the kind of inverted triangle beneath the name of the month is an artistic engraving of some theme that represents the month. So Tishrei has something for it, and et cetera, all the different months, Kislev, Nisan, those are the easy ones. So I'm going around, kind of making my way around the circle, looking at this magnificent art, and then I get to the top of it, which says, Av. So what would you think, if you're an artist engraving something on the floor of a shul, outside a shul in San Jose, Costa Rica, and you're going to engrave something to depict the Hebrew month of Av, what would you pick? What would you guess? It would be a kotel. I would have guessed that. What else? I might have depicted the menorah, second Beis HaMikdash, fame. Fire, maybe the Beis HaMikdash. You know what's in the inlay on the floor in San Jose? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It says Av on top, and then it's empty. Brilliant. Mamish. That one little picture says more about Tisha B'Av than anything else I can say the rest of the day. Shavas. That's how devastating the Chorban was. There's nothing left. Everything is done. Shavas. One last point, and then we will really begin the kinos. If you turn the page, you see about midway through the kina, actually even before that, the second line, there's 2 points that go together. The second line of the kina, Schiu ma'os simuni be'edre chaverai. The Jewish people were called dirty and repulsive. They were ridiculed. We were the nerd, the unpopular one, in the community of nations, among our peers, the other countries. If you turn the page, see middle of the kina, at the end of one of the stanzas, Karasi lamahavai hema rimuni. I thought I had friends. I called to my friends, my mahavai, and even they betrayed me. And both of these lines, the Rav used to stress every year, that these are not only meant for the time of the Churban, but describe Jewish experience since then. We have been betrayed, and the Jewish people is a lowly people in the eyes of the nations. This isn't just a one-time event, but throughout Jewish history, Ad Hayom Hazeh. The Rav used to stress over and over again how these words speak to the Jewish experience, even in the 20th and now the 21st century. whatever countries the Balakina was referring to, we could substitute the UN, the EU. I'll stop there. I don't want to say anything too controversial. We think we have friends, and then they betray us. We complain all the time with our media watchdog groups about the double standards. And we should complain. We should try to fight it. That's our hishtadlus. But we should never be surprised. That's exactly what the Kina is talking about. It's not the same rules. Bedrei chaverai look at us differently. It's not just the Churban, it's everything since. It's a very nice book. I actually read it in its entirety the last few weeks that came out from the OU a few years ago, called In the Narrow Places by a scholar from Silver Spring, Erica Brown. It's a nice book. I recommend it. It's short chapters, readings for all the 3 weeks. But there's one thing she says in her introduction which I want to disagree with. She talks about people who, as we just did, reference the Holocaust or modern Israel and terrorism and the like. She talks about how it's so hard to mourn the Churban, the Beis HaMikdash, and that when we speak about these other things like terrorism and modern Israel issues or the Holocaust, she refers to them as meaningful distractions, but still distractions from what's supposed to be the Avodah of Tisha B'Av. But the Rav disagreed with this. It's true, theoretically, a person could use them as distractions. But al pi din, objectively, they're not distractions at all. They are part of the din of Tisha B'Av, something which we'll come back to in later kinos. I once heard on a tape from Rav Asher Weiss, who made the same point, and he said it in a memorable phrase, which I've never forgotten, al yirish tzaris zenin ein grois tzara. It's all one big tzara, and it all goes back to the Churban. The next kina, kina zayin. Eicha atzta b'apcha. Said HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how could you rush your wrath? Of course, the rush is relative, since we had plenty of time to do tshuva, but like every child with every parent, when the punishment actually comes, the child feels like they should have gotten one more chance, that it's been rushed. Labe biyad adomim munecha v'lo zacharta bris ben abasarim asher berarta livchunecha. The stylistic contrast of the Eicha and lo zacharta is the way Rav Kalir sets up this kina. And the contrast, amazingly, is something which ordinarily the Rav used to stress is usher to do, and that is to challenge God's judgment. The whole kina is one big shouting at God. How dare you? How could you? Eicha! After all, how could you do it? V'lo zacharta. Each one. Eicha and lo zacharta. So, for example, the first one, he gave us in the hands of Rome, of course, the second Churban, Biyad Adomim, v'lo zacharta bris ben abasarim. The next one, the one after that, all these different examples. Eicha zanachta v'zamecha lezalzel biyad zarim zvulecha, right? You let abandoned and defiled by strangers. V'lo zacharta chituchu kechorev. You didn't remember the marriage that we had with you? Har Sinai, the marriage between the Jewish people. How could you do it? That's the theme of this kina. Eicha and Zachor Hashem mehayalanu, of course, taken from the opening pasuk of Perkei of Eicha. So I want to make 2 points about this kina. First of all, what are we asking Hashem to remember overall, if we put it all together? Zachor Hashem mehayalanu. Each one of the stanzas ends with the same refrain. Remember Hashem, Zachor Hashem, Nehayolon. What happened to us? What happened? What are we referring to? So there are some Mefarshim, if I'm not mistaken, the Ibn Ezra is among them, who say, remember all the tsaris that we already had. You punished us with this, with this. Have rachmanos on us. It's been enough already. Remember all the tzaras. But I find far more powerful the explanation of the Alshech. If you take a look at your source sheets, the first source on the sheet, let's read a little bit. We won't read it all. But look what the Alshech says, Bamakom, on that pasuk, Eicha, Perek Hei, Pasuk Aleph. Again, I think, does everyone have a source sheet? Are there extras somewhere on the Bima maybe? Anyone not have? Okay, if you don't have, please get. There are extras on the Bima if you don't have a source sheet. So says the Alshech, amazing thing. Everybody knows, everyone tells, says the same thing. Right? A pauper who never had anything. It's a Nebuch. Nebuch, you know that. They never had. It's not easy. But they never had and they never will have. Nebuch. That's one level of tzar. You see a poor person, there's certain people now. Nebuch, who we call Nebuchs. Lo yitzluchs, in another form, no need to belabor the point with other synonyms, idioms. Nebuchs, so we feel bad for them, or at least we should. We should feel bad for them. But let's be honest, our rachmonis is tempered. Ein adoma that, says the Alshech, and says the Alshech, everybody knows, and we all know, to the pain that is experienced by someone who was once an Ashir, someone who had it all, and now they have nothing left, just a kikar lechem. It's scary, not that this has not happened numerous times in history, but Nebuch, we're living either through, or I hope, shortly after, a period in which many people that we know, have experienced this. And aside from the pain of literally not having the money or the means for your basic needs, that pales in comparison to the psychological pain, the embarrassment of having once had something and not had it anymore. We know even halachically, it's a hard halacha to know how to apply, but it is a halacha that an usher who loses his wealth doesn't just have to be sustained minimally. Again, I'm not poskening, certainly not in this context. It's a hard halacha to know how to apply, but at least in hashkafa we should know. There's a halacha, is just supposed to sustain him like he's used to. Clearly that's not for the physical need, it's for the psychological and the emotional need. So says the Alshech, that's Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu. Not remember all the tzaras. Remember how great it was. Remember what we used to be. Do you know what Eretz Yisrael used to be? Do you know what it was like when there was a world with a Beis HaMikdash? What was it like for Am Yisrael when Shlomo HaMelech was king? The whole world in his fingertips. Kings looking to do trade, treaties, fear even, respect. Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu. What was it like? If you skip down to the part where I have it underlined towards the end, Zeyi Maimer B'nei HaGolos Asher Yardu L'Sharim B'Golos Hamar V'Hanimhar Ba'Amram Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu. This nefila, megavoa me'al gavoa tohom rabba. That's the pain. Ilu ha'inu mitchila, if we were just a nothing, a mamlecha shfela, that'd be one thing. Ach zochar shemayalanu bizman malchuseinu. Remember what it was. And based on that, then the next line, take a look, see what we have. Ure'es charpaseinu. A very important point, I think, to help us truly appreciate. Again, it's hard for us. I'll say something scary, but if you can't say it on Tisha B'Av, then you can never say it. Allow yourself for just a brief second to think about the overwhelming catastrophe, the unspeakable horror and pain that would be for the Jewish people now if we had no longer had a state of Israel. If it was taken away from us. Rachmana Litzlan. 65 years ago, Mele, we never had it, was one thing. But just after 65 years, and with all of the imperfections and all that we complain about, imagine what we have now, Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu, if we didn't have it after that. Can you imagine? That's what the Alshech is saying. That's what we talk about in this keynote. And one last point. Who's Lanu? Or if I may paraphrase, what you mean we, Kimosabi? Who are the Lanu? Who are we talking about? So many years ago, I had the privilege to be the Shol Meshiv in Marsha Kolel. And I heard one time I had kinos with Rabbi Willig. And he quoted from something he had heard from Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. And for years, I knew this under Rabbi Aaron's name. And then when they started publishing these kinos from the Rav, turns out it's a family tradition. The Rav says the same thing. What's Lanu? So Pashtus, you read it, us is the Jews. Unzer, us, the Jews. Zachar Shem, remember what happened to us. That's certainly what the Ashach is assuming. Said Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, said the Rav, Zachar Shem Ayalanu, us is you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and us. Lanu, we're in it together. For those of you who are using the Koran, it's on page 223. Lanu is Am Yisrael and Hashem. And this is an incredibly powerful idea which actually finds expression in a number of ways throughout Midrashim. The idea of Imo Anochi Betzara, Kaviyachol. I have a book at home, which is an English translation of a collection of essays that were the winners of an annual contest. I don't know exactly if it was just for Talmidim and Hezri Yeshivas, or coincidentally they're the ones who every year won. I'm not sure about the contest. But every year there was, for B'nai Torah, a contest of writing some essay, halacha or hashkafa, about the Holocaust. And they collected, after 10, 15 years, all the winning essays into a book, which was translated into English. It had a foreword, has a foreword, by Rabbi Lau. In that foreword is the first time he tells a story, which he then repeated in his more well-known and popular memoirs, which if you haven't read, you must. Even Mutar on Tisha B'Av, at least the first part of the book for sure. About the following story, unbelievable. 1945, he and his slightly older teenage brother have somehow miraculously survived, and they make it to Eretz Yisrael. Their uncle, who was the Rav then of Kiryat Motzkin, adopts them, takes them in, but they're still at that point initially in Yerushalayim. And because of who their father was, he had been a great, great leading Rav in Europe, who died al Kiddush Hashem in the Holocaust. They had connections with a number of great Rabbanim, who also helped. And one of their connections, which continues to this day, is with Beis Ger, the Ger Hasidus, and specifically the Ger Rebbes. At the time, the Imre Emes was still alive. He survived with a few of his children, one of whom was Rav Yisrael Alter, the successor and later to be known as the Beis Yisrael. But he was, I think, just Rosh Hashiva then, or the Rebbe's son. But already a middle-aged person who survived, escaped, but who lost his wife and entire family in the camps. And Rabbi Lau tells a story how one morning, and I say literally early in the morning, at around 4 o'clock, they're woken up by the Beis Yisrael. And he tells his older brother, the teenager, he wants to take a walk with him. And they walk for a long period, my memory tells me it was about an hour, I think Rabbi Lau describes, without saying a word. Can you imagine? Agav, the Beis Yisrael, was famous for his intensity. They say his eyes could scare anybody. I guess maybe that's one of the benefits of taking a walk at 4 in the morning, at least. He couldn't stare at you. But they walked around for an hour without talking. This little teenager who's just been through hell, lost his whole family except with his brother and then the one brother they had already in Eretz Yisrael. And the Beis Yisrael, who lost his whole family, walks with you for an hour, didn't say a word. Until finally, he grabs him and then he stares at him. He says to him, I assume in Yiddish, tell me the truth. Did you see the chimneys? I guess he nodded. Beis Yisrael followed up. Did you see the smoke? He answered. And then, after another bit of silence, the Beis Yisrael says to him, and tell me, next to the chimneys and the smoke, did you see HaKadosh Baruch Hu? That's Imo Anochi Betzara. That need and that reality that we believe in. That if there are chimneys and there's smoke, we may not understand it, but that means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was there. I'll add one final word. Just a few weeks ago, Parshas Pinchas, I came across the following beautiful idea from the same Mishpacha. Take a look at source number 2. The Gera Mishpacha. The Pasuk in Parshas Pinchas, when Moshe asks Hashem to appoint a new leader, right, Yifkod Hashem, and Moshe tells the Rabban Shalom, shouldn't be that Adas Hashem is Kitzon or She'ein Lehem Ro'eh. I don't want it should be that I'm going to die, that people will be without a shepherd. Says the Sfas Emes, that's the grandfather of the Beis Yisrael from our story. Ki be'emes Hashem Yisparach Ro'eh Yisrael. What do you mean that Hashem is, Moshe is telling him we need a Ro'eh? We always have a Ro'eh. As the Pasuk in Tehillim says, Mizmor LeDavid, Hashem Ro'i. Hashem is our Ro'eh. So what's Pshat? So the Sfas Emes explained it. He points out that in Golus, it may be written on Pinchas, but it's written for Tisha B'Av, Uba Golus, Ein Nikar. It's true that Hashem is the Ro'eh, but we don't see it. And therefore, who helps us see it generally? Alide HaTzadik, Asher Yotza Lifneim, Mechin Mokom, Shigala Kodesh Baruch Hu, Hanhaga Shalom. This is like a Hasidish mentality, no doubt. That is through the tzaddik, or you could substitute, if appropriate, through the Rebbe. That's your connection. That is through whom you realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Ro'eh. Even the Rebbe says that he's not the Ro'eh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Ro'eh, Hashem Ro'i. But we need him. So then I saw something really amazing. This is not on your sheet. But the Beis Yisrael's younger brother, who was not the current Rebbe, but the previous Rebbe before that, Rav Pinchas Menachem Alter, the Pnei Menachem. I met him. Agav, considering where we're sitting, I'll just tell you, after my second year learning in Shalavim, and I wanted to stay Shana Gimel, I went to the Rebbe, the Pnei Menachem, and he told me I should go to YU. He said, I should make Aliyah afterwards, I should come back to learn here. But it took me a while, but I made it. But I went to him asking him what I should do. He said, this is the yeshiva from Rabbi Yosheber. This is a true story. I get more on it another time. You should go to YU. So the Pinchas Menachem quotes this vort from his grandfather from the Sfas Emes, but then he adds one little vort. Look at the pasuk in Tehillim. Mizmor LeDavid Hashem Ro'i Lo Echsar. What's Lo Echsar? So he adds, how do we usually translate it? I shall not want. I shall not be lacking anything. Says the Pnei Menachem beautifully. Lo Echsar. I shouldn't be chaser the feeling that Hashem is Ro'i. Objectively, ontologically, if you will. Of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always there. He is Ro'i, always. But I beg Hashem, says David HaMelech, Hashem Ro'i Lo Echsar. I shouldn't ever feel that He's not there. I should never be chaser of that feeling. And he adds, the Pasuk by the Akedah, right? Yaras HaMakom, what does the Pasuk say? Meirachok. He says, that is the Avoda. Sometimes we feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Rachok. He's far. But the Avoda of Avram and our Avoda, when we feel that, is nevertheless Vayares HaMakom, to see HaMakom Yenachem, to see that the Ro'i, Lo Echsar, whether in the chimneys, in the smoke, in the bus bombings, in the Crusades, and in the burning flames of the Chorban, Hashem Ro'i, He's always there, He is our shepherd. We just have to hope, Lo Echsar, that we're not lacking that feeling. Many of the Pirchei Kahuna gathered Umaftechos HaHechal B'Yodon. They had the keys to the Beis HaMikdash with them. Olu L'Gag HaHechal, they went up to the roof of the Beis HaMikdash. V'omru lefanov, and they called out to the Rabbanu Shel Olam. Hoel v'lo zachinu lios gizbarin ne'amanim. Since clearly we were not faithful caretakers, We didn't do our jobs. This was still at a time where leaders took responsibility for failure. Hoil, v'lo zachinu lios gizbara ne'amanim, yu maftechos masuros l'cha. We don't deserve them, and we don't need them anymore. These keys belong to you. And in a powerful image, the Gemara describes, v'zarkum klape mala. They threw the keys up towards the Shamayim. Yatusa ke'en pisas yad, v'kiblasan mehem. In some divine form, some heavenly hand, whoosh, came out of the heavens and grabbed the keys and took them back. And right after that, the Gemara concludes, Behem, the Kohanim, Kafsu, they jumped, V'naflu latocha or. They jumped to their fiery deaths in the Beis HaMikdash itself. How do you understand this Gemara? What's the point of the Gemara? What's the message of the Gemara? So, like the Kina Chavatzalas HaSharon itself, one could argue, perhaps, Bipashtus, that this is a compliment. This is showing the dedication. I said before, the responsibility, but not only the responsibility. You see the love, the pain. Only someone who loved the Beis HaMikdash so much could be in as much pain as they were. Perhaps. But perhaps not. At the funeral of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, his son and his successor, Reb Itzla Volozhiner, got up to speak in front of everyone who was there and directed his words in particular at the Talmidim of the Volozhiner Yeshiva. Now, we can only imagine, but we can imagine, just how overwhelming their sense of loss was. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, a larger-than-life figure and personality, someone who transformed the entire world with his creation of the modern yeshiva, Talmud Mufak of the Gaon, a genius, a tzaddik, everything you want to say, every appellation in his own right, Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Now we're like in awe even when we hear that name now. Imagine the Talmidim. And now imagine how they felt when he died. I can't even imagine something, you know. Maybe you could imagine, maybe Chabad when the Rebbe died. I'm being serious. I'm not even sure if there's any, there aren't that many recent, not just a Rebbe, not just a leader, not just a Rosh Hashiva, their whole lives were connected. So how do you pick up the pieces? How do you go on? So Rabbi Itzala spoke at the Levaya at the funeral, and he quoted this Gemara about the Pirkei Kahuna. And then he thundered at them. You think the Kohanim were noble? You think the Kohanim were dedicated? They did a selfless, a great thing? Adaraba. Just the opposite. They gave up. They were miyayesh. And here he says something amazing. You have to be a bit of a soldier to say it. But the Rav used to repeat this. Had they persevered, had they not given up, had they gone on, the Beis HaMikdash would have been rebuilt shortly thereafter. It would have been a very small gullus. But they didn't persevere. They gave up. They threw away the keys. The message, says Reb Itzla, is that don't be like the Kohanim. No matter how bad it seems, no matter how bleak it looks, don't throw away the keys. You have no right to be miyayish. I once saw somewhere from the Chiddush Arim, the first Ger Rebbe, Yes, how could Yush be Kona? Since when is Yush? You know, and but Metzia, Yush could be a Kenyan. So he says it's not. There's no Maisa Kenyan. But a Jew is usher to be Miyash. And if you are, the Torah punishes you. Takes away your things. Said Rabbi Itzala, don't throw away the keys. Don't give up. Don't be Miyash. I think about this a lot. I think about this a lot recently. Because it looks really bad. The assimilation, the kids at risk, the youth going off the derech, the scandals, abuse, other things. Need I mention sinas chinam? I think if someone were to go to treatment for a play or a movie, where they would describe in the 3 weeks and in the Shavua Shechalbo things that are happening right before our eyes, no one would have accepted such a thing. It's unrealistic. It's too cliche. Too convenient. That in the 9 days, in the Shavua Shechalbo, on Erev Tisha B'Av, people would be talking the way they're talking. And yet, do we have any wonder why there's... I, for one, am not bothered at all by why Mashiach's not here. I have lots of things I don't understand in life. I have lots of kashas on their body, Shalom. This is not one of them. You don't have to go too far to understand where Mashiach is, and he's not coming, not the way we're acting. And yet, the Kina speaks to us. Rabbi Itzel of Elojiner speaks to us. No matter how bad it seems, never give up. Don't be like the Kohanim. Don't throw away the keys. Don't give up. Don't ever, ever give up. The Kohanim gave up. But no matter how bad it seems, each of us, Lo Alecha Am Lachal Ligmor, we maybe can't do it all ourselves, but we're also not Ben Churin Libatel Mimana. Each of us, if we don't give up, if we don't throw away the keys, if we don't make the mistake of the Mishmari Kahuna, of the Pirchei Kahuna, then we can have our little place, our role, and in fact turning the tide, and perhaps, in fact, bringing the Gula, and in fact, Mashiach will come. The next Kina, Kina Yud Aleph, is the oldest and most authoritative Kina we have, by a Konein Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu. It's already in the Tanakh, the Lashon of a Kina, in Divrei Hayamim. This is the Kina that the Navi himself wrote, or broadly at least, about the Melech Yoshiyahu. It's an incredible story. We know from Tanakh, from Chazal. He was the grandson of one of the most wicked kings we ever had, Menashe. His father wasn't much better. And they had systematically, basically wiped out genuine Yiddishkeit, monotheism even, from Eretz Yisrael. Avodah Zarah was rampant. And then his father was assassinated by some of his own guards, and he took the throne at how old? 8. Amazing. We struggle to find middle-aged leaders. One of the greatest leaders of all time became king at 8. We're told that in a circumstance which others might see as a coincidence, which of course we know was not, that we're doing shiputzim, as we would say, on the Beis HaMikdash, and they found an old Torah. And the impression that you get, shocking though it sounds, is that until that point, the Melech had never seen a Torah before. That's how far gone they were. And they're shocked and inspired that when they opened the Torah, it was at, wouldn't you know it, the Tochacha. And to his great credit, he took this seriously. And not only did he do tshuva, but he was the first and probably, Ad Hayom Hazeh, the greatest kiruv professional that ever lived, bringing a complete revolution of kiruv, of chozer b'tshuva, to Am Yisrael. And we're told with tremendous detail about how the lust for Yetzer Hara was so great that he had to send police, almost guards, to all the houses to make sure. And he got reports back that there was no Avodah Zarah left in all of Eretz Yisrael. But this led, unfortunately, perhaps to a little overconfidence and a tragic mistake. When there was a request from Paro to use Eretz Yisrael as a way of passing through on his way to fight a war, the Jews were not involved in the war, but they just wanted to pass through peaceably. Despite what the Navi told him to do, which was to let them pass, he mistakenly said no, because he felt that this was an opportunity to fulfill the Nevuah, to fulfill the Pasuk, that if we're doing everything that we're supposed to do, there's not going to be a sword in Eretz Yisrael. Not only will we not have to fight, but there will literally not be a sword even passing through. And he was so convinced that they had reached that Madrega that he said no. But he made a tragic mistake, because, in fact, at least with a small percentage of the Jews, the love and the lust that they had for Avodah Zarah was so great that they had devised a way to hide their Avodah Zarah even from the guards. And as much as he had accomplished, it wasn't as much as he had thought. And there was Avodah Zarah still in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the Pasuk wasn't relevant. And because of his tragic mistake, he paid the ultimate price. He died. And as many pointed out, I think the Rav hints at this as well, he had been the last hope to avoid and to avert the Charbon. And with his death, in essence, the judgment was complete. Of course, the Chiddush of this Kina, the radical Chiddush, is that it's a Kina about one person. The focus on the individual. I think there are two reasons for this, both equally important. The first is psychological or emotional. And that is that it helps us personalize things. It helps us focus. I hate to quote him, but Stalin, Yimach Shemo, was right when he said that one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. A kina on one person, a great person, but just one, helps us get in touch with the tragedy. A number of years ago, the English youth outreach group of United Synagogue called Tribe, forgive me if this is imprecise, but I think it's their version of NCSY, or close to it, published a booklet called 60 Days for 60 Years. Sixty essays commemorating the 60th anniversary of the Holocaust. An introduction to this is a very small foreword. If you have the book or you want to get it, XXVIII, page 25, an introduction by Rabbi Lau. And Rabbi Lau tells the following. I'll just read, it's two paragraphs. At 8 years old, I was the youngest survivor of Buchenwald. And when I was 10, I had already picked up the Diary of Anne Frank. I wanted to see what everyone was talking about. I read it and I was astonished. That's it? This is what everyone's talking about? The whole book is not to be compared to one day in Buchenwald. Where's the concentration camp, the torture, the killings? I couldn't understand why people were so excited about this book. But then I got older. And that's when I realized the book's success lay in the fact that it didn't speak about millions. It was one person's story with one human being you can identify. For the first time I understood what Yad Vashem means. As the Navi says, I will give them Yad Vashem, a hand and a name. One hand, it's in Lashon Yachid, one name. If it is single, it will convince you. You cannot bear millions of deaths, but one name you can understand. The idea of names, of focusing on individuals, is so important. We don't know the names of most of the people, obviously, who died in the either Korban. Some we do, of course, but not most. But think about even recent events. Rilla was mentioning the Holocaust. Just a few weeks ago, I saw the video presentation, it's on YouTube, you can watch it yourself, from the Sinai Indaba in South Africa. There's a plenary session with the Chief Rabbi of South Africa and Rabbi Beryl Wine, where they're talking about and promoting the book that they both just co-wrote, all about the great tradition and the Gedolim of Lita, of Lithuania. So I don't know if it's in the book, but in South Africa, Rabbi Wine mentioned the story. It wasn't about him, but he mentioned the story of Rav Motel Katz. He's not in the story, but someone else, another Talmud, was. Rav Motel Katz, son-in-law of the Telz Rosh Yeshiva in Europe, he is able to escape, and with his brother-in-law, co-founded Telz in Cleveland, Telz in America. At the end of the war, he found out that his wife and 10 children had all been murdered. Horrific. Well, the point of Rabbi Wine's story was that some years later, despite everyone always admired of Katz, they knew about his personal tragedy, but he had overcome it, was a person of great simcha and inspiration, in addition to, of course, being a great gadol. But one day, a Talmud, again, not Rabbi Wine, but another Talmud who told this to Rabbi Wine, was walking by the office when he overheard Rabbi Katz, Rav Motel Katz, crying terribly. And the Talmud, I guess, was close. So he said, tells the Rosh Yeshiva, tell me, why are you crying? What happened? So listen to what Rav Katz told him. This, as far as I could tell, is a quote. He said, I had 10 children. And today, for the first time, I couldn't remember all of their names. Now they're dead. Yad Vashem. One hand, one name. When we individualize, then we can relate. Emotionally, this kina helps us. I think there's a second point as well. It's not just psychological or emotional. I think the kinos are making a philosophical, hashkafic statement to us about the absolute and inherent value of every life. I won't read it inside. It's well known, I'm sure, to you anyway. But if you take a look at sources 5 and 6 on the sheet, you have two very famous Rambams. The first is the Rambam Paskening based on the Yerushalmi and Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, the famous din of Tnu Lanu Echad Mikem. Non-Jews surround the city. They say, give us one to kill or we'll kill everybody. And the accepted halacha in the Gemara, the Rambam Paskins, they should all die, Yehargu Kulam, V'al Yimsru Lehem Nefesh Achas Mi Yisrael. We don't give up one Jew. But they're going to die anyway. We still don't. Why not? So, it's the next Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Rotzeach, Hashmir Sa Nefesh, speaks about different situations in which a person may not actually get punishment in Beis Din, but he still caused the death of somebody. Rambam tells us in Source 6, even though maybe you won't escape technically punishment, but you should realize that what you did was a terrible thing. Kol ha'mabed nefesh achas miYisrael, ki lo'ibed kol ha'olam kulo. We like to only focus on the second half, but kol ha'makayim nefesh achas miYisrael, ki lo'kiyim kol ha'olam kulo. But kol ha'mabed nefesh is true as well. What the Kina is telling us is not just that we can relate to one person, but that if it would have only been one person, it would have been enough to mourn and to lament. If it had only been one person, it would have been kolam kulo, like the whole world. So I just want to add one name, a name which I have to admit, until this week, of course I knew, sort of, but for whatever reason, and I make no excuses, but I wasn't previously sensitive enough. I didn't pay enough attention. And that's the name of Eviatar Barovsky. Just in the news the other day, which is why I was reminded. Eviatar Barovsky, Hashem Yimkom Domo, was murdered not long ago. He was stabbed in the back at the Tapuach Junction, the Shomron. And there have been so many. All one runs into the next. Baruch Hashem, it's been relatively Bli Ayin Hara quiet. But still, with so many over the years, sometimes we forget. So how about us? We have a tzibur here. Let's remember one name. With many more, but let's focus on one. Eviatar Barovsky, Hashem Yimkom Domo. He was just 31 years old. A father of five in 7 years. Little kids. A wife, now an almana. Children are yesomim. Who can forget that picture? And if not, go home after davening and Google and then hit the pictures part, it'll come up. I think it was pinged from Vosses Nayas, so you could feel good. It's from. Who could forget that picture from the Levaya of one of his little sons? He's wearing a bright orange t-shirt, hugging his father's talus-draped body. Eviatar Barovsky, one person. And the one who killed him was Nechrav, Kol Olam Kulo. For those children, for that wife, for that family, the whole world is destroyed. But it wasn't just them. He was a tzaddik. He was an ish chesed. He was involved in the therapeutic psychodrama, doing plays and stuff to enable others to overcome traumatic experiences. Eviatar Barovsky. Whether we're talking about the Churban, the Holocaust, Islamic terrorism, Alle Yiddishe Tzaras, Zen in Ein Groese Tzara. Vaykonen Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu, Eicha Eli, Konenu Meila. The word ko is used in many contexts, in many psukim, to connote either a prediction, a bracha, or even just an association with great blessing, with great hashkacha pratis. So for example, we see here the first ko, a ko, by the Bris Ben Abasarim, ko yeh lanetzach. The next stanza refers to, we invoke the Akedah, like on Rosh Hashanah, ne'elcha ad ko, again that's the word. The ko in Birkas Kohanim, the promise made, or the reference, the allusion to Moshe Rabbeinu, v'yifen ko v'cho, ko tomar, l'shalach am l'avdecha, etc. You go through the kina, numerous references to ko, and how ko either predicts or is associated with something that was great. And each time we ask the Rabbanu Shalom, a ko, what happened to that ko? Hein Ata, look what's happening now. The theme of this kina therefore can be summed up as follows. This is a kina which asks questions but has no answers. This is a kina which expresses our confusion and our bewilderment. What happened? How did it get so bad? Where did all the old brachas go? And we've all had this lahavdil in our own lives. Sometimes it's for good, but unfortunately, many, if not all of us, have had it with difficult experiences, where in the moment, we're in the moment. But then sometimes afterwards, we look back and we try to think, how did it happen? Something was so good, and now it's so bad. And sometimes the answer is clear, but a lot of times, life is complicated, and we're confused, and we're bewildered. And we all have our echo moments, And we have to look and say, but Vehein Ata. In this book I previously mentioned by Mrs. Brown, so she reminded me, she references there in the book, a quote which I had read previously, but she made the connection here to a quote from the Rav, which Rabbi Rakefet includes in volume 1 of his book, which describes how the Rav was asking his father, how come there's so many unanswered questions in the Gemara? How come so often we just don't know the answer? And the Rav describes that Rav Moshe told him that it was supposed to be a lesson for human beings, that we should learn that we cannot always understand everything. Sometimes there is no answer that's accessible to us. Eko vehenata v'tzarachian. A number of years ago, I heard a very, very powerful idea, a powerful way, expression, I should say, of this idea. I was listening to a shiur from Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, and he quoted a teaching, which I want to share with you, of Rav Nachman Mibreslov. And it goes like this. It's very short, but it's very deep. Rav Nachman taught the following. He said the word teku, we have tekus in the Gemara all the time, right? Teku is mechusar tikun. What does that mean? Teku, the letters are almost identical with tikun. What's it missing? It's missing the nun pshuta, that long straight nun. So teku is mechusar tikun. That's step one. Step two is, once the nun is missing, once the nun pshuta is missing, it's mechusar, then the nun becomes degraded and humiliated. The nun becomes bent, and the word turns into kinos. Think about it. It's the exact same letters, just rearranged, and instead of it being a long straight nun, it's a bent nun. Teku is missing tikun, and it becomes kinos. So, many of us, if we would just read this, we would, well, many of us wouldn't be reading this. But if we read it, I would probably have kept on going. But if I could elaborate on the explanation that I heard from my Weinberger, I think the lesson is as follows. We've all had this experience, certainly the men in the room, learning a difficult Gemara. And you get to the end of the sugya, and it's just teku. There's nothing more frustrating. There's nothing. You want at least you want some closure. And then you get to the teku. But it's not just that way in Gemara. It's that way in life. Life is full of lots of tekus. But here's the key, and this is the brilliant insight of Rav Nachman. Teku stands right in between. It's right at the gateway of two opposite extremes. Teku's in the middle, and it can either go in the direction of tikun or in the direction of kinos. It's the same letters. It's so close. Tikun and kinos. Same exact letters. So close. And yet so far apart. What's the difference between a tikun and kinos? The difference is teku. In other words, how do we deal with the tekus in life? We've all had them. Regarding the Churban, there was confusion. Eko, heinata. There were tekus about what happened. Why? It's not fair. What about me? I didn't do it. She didn't do it. Give me another chance. The Navi really didn't say. This one didn't say. This one did. Lots of tekus about what happened. And when we don't get an answer, when we don't fight through the dips, When there's no tikkun, then all we're left with is kina. Because there's nothing more painful than a suffix. Not in learning and not in life. That confusion, that bewilderment. The only way to have tikkun in life is to learn how to live with the tekus. There's no one who's spared from some tekus. No one's life is so blessed. Not individually, not as a nation. We all have tekus. Things we don't understand. Things which, from our perspective, should be different. Should be better. And they're real. I'm not belittling them one bit. They're real. And if we can't live with them, they become kinos. If we don't figure out a way. But if we can, as Rav Moshe told the Rav, it's one of the avodas, one of our avodas Hashem, is to learn how to live with the tekus. To learn to accept the humility as a human being that we can't understand everything. Then it's not a kinos, then it can be a tikkun. And that's a musr for us. Because we all have these tekus. Whether it's in our relationship with Hashem, why did Hashem do this to me? Why did he not do that? Whether it's in our relationships with other people, but I'm l'chaveiro, how come she's not nice to me? How come he's not my friend anymore? How come my wife doesn't love me? How come my husband doesn't love me? How come they don't respect me? Ben Adam La'atzmo perhaps is the most painful. How come I'm not what I thought I would be? How come I'm not as successful? How come I'm not as good looking? How come I'm not this? I'm not that? How come I'm not short-tempered? Why don't I have the right midos? How come I don't daven better? How come I don't learn better? How come I'm not a better father? I'm not a better mother? How come? We have a lot of tekus. And if we don't learn to live with them, they can become kinos. That's the confusion. And that's what happened to the Jews in the time of the Chorban. Which is kina yudalid. Eicha eis asher kvarasuhu tava meni ligvos shiehu. This is a very complex interweaving of psukim and rhymes and aleph bet. And it's mainly dealing with the prophecies of the future Churban. I imagine that there's two musars, two benefits, two insights we get from contemplating all the prophecies of the Churban before the Churban. First, it's a part of a tziruk hadin. Even though we just said eiko, we don't understand, tzarechian, teiku, but now we say we do understand. Because Hashem warned us. We have no excuses. There were warnings about the future. But I think there's also a second point, much more painful actually. What's even worse than suffering a tragedy? What's even worse than the tragedy itself? The anticipation. Often. If it happens, it happens. We deal with it. But the fear, the anticipation, the anxiety, that feeling of the cherev hanging over us, that could be Gehenna. So, if you ignored it, like when you ignore the bad prognosis from the doctor, denial works until it doesn't work anymore. But once you get past the denial, it's true, then if you don't do anything about it, you have no one to blame but yourself. But whether you do something about it or not, just that knowledge can be very frightening. I want to focus on highlight one point of the kina, though. And that is, it's a long kina. I think it may be the longest we've done yet. But if you look about halfway through, I'm using the Koren, so if you have that, it's on page 333. But even if you don't, the kinos are arranged alphabetically in the Aleph base. So this is for the letter Kaf. And the letter Kaf, we say, Kolu Kislei Tzir Kishulach. Who is that? Who's the Tzir? The Tzir is like the envoy. That's a reference to Moshe. And the envoy Moshe was Kalu. He felt faint when he was first appointed, when he was designated. Of course, this is a reference to when Moshe was appointed at the Sneh to take the Jews out of Egypt. Venom. So he's faint. Kalu Kislei Tzir Kishulach Venom. He feels faint when he's designated. Shlach na biyad tishlach. A reference, which we'll get back to in a minute, from Pasuk Yud Gimel and Perek Dalet of Shmos. And then Moshe, the words are put into his mouth here. Kima betza li lihishtalach. What's the point of sending me? V'acharai giladi yishulach. When after me anyway, you're going to have to send the Giladi to finish the job. So this kina was not part of the regular cycle of kinos that the Rav used to say every year in Boston. But I heard once, I believe it was in person actually, from Rabbi Schachter, that there was 1 year of the years that he was in Boston, there was 1 year where the Rav changed his order, his Seder, and he decided to do Kina Yud Dalet. And he focused on this stanza. And he gave the following explanation. Let's think back for a minute to that story in Jewish history, in the beginning of Sefer Shmos. Starting already in Perek Gimel, going through here in Perek Dalet, Moshe is confronted by the presence of the Ribono Shel Olam at the Sneh. Now is the time. It's time to go. You are the man. Go redeem, go save your brothers, go redeem the Jewish people. We all know what happens for the better part of Perek Gimel and the beginning of Perek Dalet. Moshe says, no, I won't go. He refuses, he has all the excuses, and each time he has an excuse, Hashem bats it down. It's if you think about it for a minute, it's actually an astounding conversation, which according to Chazal lasted a week. Back and forth and back and forth, and finally, as Hashem is really getting to his wit's end, so Moshe has this response, which when you read the Pesukim is incredibly vague and ambiguous. Shlach na biyad tishlach. After that, Hashem says, enough is enough. You're going and you'll have help. And the story continues as we know it inevitably did. What is shlach na biyad tishlach? If you read the Pesukim, you have no idea. It's a big discussion in the Mefarshim. Rashi quotes a Deya that it's a reference to Aaron, which works well with the very next Pasuk, which mentions Aaron. Shlach ne'obiyat tishlach. Moshe is saying, send Aaron instead of me. So Hashem responds, I'll send Aaron with you. That's Rashi's pshat. But the Rav, that 1 year in Boston, said no. There's a different pshat. When the Baal HaKina makes his reference, as we just read, as he put it, that the Baal HaKina has lichten cup. The Baal HaKina had in mind, not that Rashi, but a teaching of the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, which is on your source sheet, page 8. Source 8. I think the Rav referred to it in the Koran, they referred to it as Perek Mem. In the Bar Ilan Sidi Ram, they use a different version of the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, it's Perek Lamates, but it's the same teaching. The Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer describes or elaborates on this conversation, this amazing conversation between Moshe and Hashem, and says the following. Amar lefanav ribon ko'olamim. So after, I don't know where this was in the week, probably towards the end of the week, if not the very end, Moshe again says, send who you'll send. Shlach nabiyat tishlach. So Rashi says he meant Aaron. Says the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, no. Ratzalomer, who does he mean? Biyad oso ha'ish sha'ata osid lishloach. Don't send me. Send the person who I know. Obviously Moshe b'nevuah b'ruach ha'kodesh. Send the person who you're eventually going to have to send. Who's that a reference to? Says the Baal HaKina, of course. The Giladi. Elio Hanavi, the Mavasar HaGeula. So Hashem says back to Moshe, Amar Lo, Didn't I say I'm going to send you? You're going to go to Paro? You have to go. And what about the Giladi? What about the Eliyahu Navi? End of the second line. Ul'osha isha ata, Omer, ani shaleach. The one that you say I should send? Don't worry. I will send them eventually. I'll send them eventually, as the Pasuk says, as we read at the end of the Haftorah. Hine anochi shaleach lemes Eliyahu Navi, heishiv levavo salbanim, v'lev banim alavosam. I'll send him. Lasod lavo. But now, it's your turn. So that, said the Rav, that's pshat. This is what the Kina says.
Moshe is getting faint. He's getting tired. He didn't want to do it. He's fighting for a week. So he says, Shlach labia tishlach. Kima betzali lihishtalach. What's the point? What's missing in the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, which the Rav noted, the Balakina fills in, is we understand Moshe says, I can't do it. I'm kvad peh, etc. They won't listen to me. They won't believe me. So we don't really understand this. We need a whole chumash here to understand that story. But on some level, we could understand if you're going to be making excuses to Hashem, which is hard for us to imagine that we would ever do such a thing, but if you're going to be making excuses and turning down Hashem's repeated and direct command, if you could do such a thing, the first few things that Moshe says make sense. I'm not up for the job. I can't do it. It won't work. But why is he saying send Eliyahu? It's a total non sequitur. It has nothing to do with anything. So in the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, we don't get that, any explanation. So says the Balakina, Kima betzali lihishtalach. Because what's the point? If anyway, you're going to have to send Eliyahu. So, what I think clearly the Kina is getting at, but what the Rav was marichon, what the Rav explained, was as follows. Why was Moshe not willing to go? Was it insecurity? Hard to believe. Was it selfishness, a lack of Avas Yisrael? He didn't care about the Jews? Obviously not. So why did he want to go? Hashem says the time is now. You can be the instrument of redemption. Who wouldn't want that job? Especially if you really care about it. So why didn't Moshe want to go? So the Rav said, basically, more or less, this is the reason. In essence, Hashem, Moshe is telling the Rabbanu Shlomo, what's the purpose of sending me? Ma betza. I know what's going to happen. I'll lead them out. And we're going to have a great Kriyas Yamsuf. It'll be amazing. But then we're going to wander around the desert. That's not going to work out so well. And it's going to be 40 years. But we'll make it to Eretz Yisrael. And eventually there'll be a first Beis HaMikdash. But, Rabbanu Shlalom, you know what's going to happen. After 410 years, it's going to be Geferlach. It's going to get destroyed. I know, there'll be a second Beis HaMikdash. And we'll have that for 420 years. It won't be as nice as the first, but it'll be good enough. But then there's going to be another Chorban. And after that, a few years later, Asar Haruge Malchus, unspeakable horrors, which we will try to speak about today. Then at the end of the 11th and the 12th centuries, the various crusades. We can even skip to the 15th century, the Spanish expulsion. The 17th century, the Chmelnytsky massacres. We'll skip a bit to the 20th century, the Holocaust. In the 21st century, we're going to have precious yeshiva bachrim murdered in their own yeshiva in front of their gemaras. Brides are going to be blown up the night before their wedding. Fathers are going to be stabbed. Babies are going to be injured when the car is stoned. I beg of you, don't send me. Send Eliyahu HaNavi. Let's just end this. Let's get to the good stuff permanently. Bring the Mevaser HaGeula. This is what we want. We want the Geula. Moshe knew, apparently, that what he was going to usher in was only temporary. And it was just going to be the beginning of a cycle of start and stop, one step forward, two steps back. Simcha, and then Sarah. Geula, but then Golos. Don't send me. Send Eliyahu HaNavi. Let's get it done. Bring the Giladi. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu answers, not now. Now is your turn. Eliyahu? Yes, I will send him in the future. But now is your turn.
Who doesn't feel like Moshe? Don't, if we had a choice, wouldn't we want to say exactly what Moshe said? Don't we feel that way all the time? My grandmother got remarried. Her second husband for many, many years was in essence the grandfather for me and my sisters. He also just passed away about a year or so ago. And whenever I used to see him, my grandpa Herman used to say, "Nu, what's going to be? When's Mashiach going to come?" He lived with it. He was really somebody who was Tzipis L'Yeshua. That's how we all should be. And on some level, we all have those moments. We just want it to end already. Can't we just get to what Hashem promised? We believe. We believe. We really do. So where is it? We have some good stuff, but then some bad stuff, and some good stuff, some bad stuff. Right now, some really bad stuff. We have the bad stuff other people do to us. We have the worst stuff we do to ourselves. Just send Eliyahu already. Send the Giladi. And this is one big teku. This is the teku of this kina. We're confused, we're bewildered. We don't yet have the tikkun, so we have the kinos. The next kina is kina tet zayin. We'll skip to kina tet zayin. Zachor Eis Asher Asa Tzar Bifinim. This is a very well-known kina. It uses words from the fifth parak of Eicha. Zachor Eis Asher Asa Tzar Bifinim, a reference in the second Churban to Titus Harasha. And this kina is based on the accounts which we have in Gittin, Medrash, all about the horrible and horrific acts of depravity of Titus. In each of the four lines, each quartet, the first and the third line begin with the first word from those psukim in Perkei of Eicha. And then the second word of those lines are the Aleph Bet. It's just brilliant. I'm not a poet by any stretch, but this is just brilliant to think about how somebody could do such a thing. Zachor Es, then the Aleph, the third line. Right, Nachal Aseinu, B'es, with the Beis. Next, Yisomim Gi'el, with the Gimel. Third line, Mimenu Dalach, with the Dalet. Just something to keep in mind. That's the structure of the kina. But as I said, thematically, it goes through these terrible things that he did, the fear that he brought, the bottom letter nun there, nashim, kshu kiba aritz, people were scared, sarim, Lupasu, Bavo, Paritz, they were panicked with his arrival. Tremendous fear. Zakanim, Nivasu, the elders trembled. We think it's okay, at least Nebuchadnezzar is gone. Shabbas Sotain, but Vayavo Admon, but Rome took its place. Reference to stabbing the parochas, the blood coming out. And then perhaps the emotional apex, or really the low point, is the famous story which is alluded to in the last three stanzas of the children. The story of the 300 children on the boats. That's the last three stanzas, starting with the paragraph of Ata Katsafta Vehir Shesa lefanos yuladim asher ein behem kol meum. The children, misham lehipanos, they were expelled. Shilchum leeretz utz b'shalosh svinos. Again, in the next stanza, and then refers to their end. Kitohamos ba'u ad nafshan. So this is, these three stanzas are the Baal HaKinah's poetic summary of a story which is included not only in the Gemara, but also in Medrash Eicha. There's slight differences in the account between the Gemara and the Medrash. And I want to just read with you together source number 9 on your sheet. And that is the Medrash's account of this story. Again, it's the last three stanzas of the Kina, but it's based on the more in-depth description both in the Gemara and the Medrash. Source number 9, Perek Aleph, or Parsha Aleph, Memhei, in Eicha Rabbah. Al Eila ani bochia. Aposyonos male gimos sfinos migdole Yerushalayim lahoshivan v'kolon shalromi. So they gathered together three boatloads of children from Yerushalayim, not only to exile them, not only to enslave them, but lahoshivan kolon shalromi. And it's clear from the continuation in the Gemara and the Medrash, which we'll read in a second, that they were not just being taken as slaves, but forgive me for the phrase, but it's reared its head in contemporary life as well. It was an ancient sex trade. They were going to be used for horrific, horrific acts of immorality. So it's hard to understand exactly how this happened if they're on different boats, but at least in the using the poetic license, the Medrash continues that the boat of the boys said to the boat of the girls, Amru l'nashim, Mavakshos asun lakach? Do you really want this? No, it doesn't really mean that. It means, are you willing? Of course they didn't want it, but are you willing to let it happen? Amru lahem lav. And they said, no, we are not willing to let this happen. So then the boys made a kal v'chomer. Amru, they said, Ma shedarkon lakach, einon rotzos, anu alachas, kama v'kama. As horrible as what the girls would have to experience, they would be given to the men of Rome. As horrible as that is, it's an abuse of something which is otherwise natural and ideally even holy. But at least it's otherwise natural. Apparently, you see from Chazal that the boys were also going to be given to the men of Rome. And that is described here in the Kina as not being Darkan lakach, unnatural, more depraved, more immoral. So the boys said, if that's the case, so they asked the question, the children, boys, the girls, Tomru, turning over the page, Im mashlichim anu atzmenu liyam, anu boim l'chai olam haba. There was no escape, they're on the high seas. But apparently they weren't chained down. The only solution they had to avoid this immoral fate was to jump to their deaths in the ocean. But imagine now, little children on boats, their parents presumably either already in exile or dead, with the fate that they knew awaited them, and they have a halachic kasha. I want to ask a shayla. If we'll jump to our deaths, ma'avir atzmo ledas, suicide is usur, everybody knows that. Apparently even the kids. Are we going to be giving up our olam haba? They didn't fear death, but they did fear losing their olam haba. So the Medrash tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is overhearing this entire conversation. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is silent, but he can't hold it back. And now after silently listening to this conversation, he bursts forth. Miyad heir HaKadosh Baruch Hu eseinehim. Whether someone had a moment of inspiration where they heard a voice, whatever. Hashem tells them, brings their attention to the Pasuk in Tehillim, where Hashem says, Mi Bashan Ashiv. No matter how far away you are, even in Bashan, I can bring you back. Ashiv mi Metzulos Yam. I can even bring you back from the watery depths of the sea. Even if your body was destroyed, Absajigun or others speak about the Tipshim, who couldn't understand how could someone who died a violent death in this world ever experience a Tchias HaMesim. When I was younger, I was bothered by that question, but Absajigun calls that a stupid question. I guess when I was younger, I was stupid. But at least in the Medrash, apparently someone could have had a Havamina. So the Tillim says no. Even Mibein Shiara, doesn't matter what happened to you in life. And even Mimetzulos Yam, even if you were from the depths of the sea, doesn't matter. So that's the Pashtus. But the understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave these children was, it didn't just mean someone who accidentally drowned is on the bottom of the sea, but it was written with these children in mind, even someone who jumps to their deaths. Sometimes when we're learning, whether it's a Pasuk or a Gemara, we think we have a Pshat, so we wonder, is this really right Pshat, or is it just us speculating? So here at least we know that Chazal tell us, again, whether they heard the voice of Hashem or they were just inspired, but this is the right Pshat, says the Gemara, says the Medrash. This is the right Pshat. Mimetzulos Yam even refers to someone who jumps in these circumstances, obviously, specifically, to their death in the Mitzulos Yam, in the depths of the sea. Kemashma'o. So once they have this resolve, they know that it's mutter, they're going to go to Olam Haba. So then the Medrash elaborates. I didn't give you all the psukim because it talks about either the children themselves said certain psukim or the Medrash associates certain psukim. But it tells us one by one, Amdakat Rishona, they said or was said about them certain psukim, then they jumped. Amdakat Shnia, then Kashlishis. All of them, Hishlichau Atzman Liyam. They all jumped to their deaths. A surprise awaited the people in Rome when the boats finally got there. Empty boats. They jumped to their deaths in the ocean. Now, we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was aware of all this because the Medrash just told us that he got involved. So imagine you're the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, Avinu Shebashamayim. You're the father overhearing his children have such a conversation and then with an act of such unbelievable mesiras nefesh did what they did. How would you react? So here is the most important difference. The Gemara doesn't tell us. And the Gemara, you're missing this. But in the Medrash adds the following postscript. V'ruach ha-kodesh tzavachas va'omeres, HaKadosh Baruch Hu screams out, al eile ani bochia. About these children, this Mesiras Nefesh, this dedication, I am brought to tears. Now, this is an amazing, amazing, amazing line. First of all, because the Pasuk wasn't said by Hashem. It's who's Eli in the Pasuk? Who's Ani Bochia, I should say. The Ani is the Navi. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu appropriates the Pasuk, puts it in his own mouth, supersedes his own identity for the Navis and says, Al Eila Ani Bochia. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is moved to tears. Hashem is with us. Imo Anochi Batsara. Zachar Hashem Mehaya Lanu, as we spoke about before. I want to mention just 2 points on this Medrash. Number one, the question that the children asked. So first of all, it's an amazing thing. I tried to give that impression as I read the Kina, as I read the Medrash. Could you imagine asking the question? Growing up, my father used to tell me all the time whenever we'd speak about Rav Ashri's Tshuvas Mimamakim. He himself is not a child of survivors, but my mother is, and the Holocaust hung over our family, as did for many families, very clear, very ever-present cloud. And my father always used to tell me how the most impressive, the most inspiring thing about the Holocaust weren't the answers of the Rabbanim, but that the people asked the questions. So I always thought that, and I still think that, and This is Ma'aseh Avos Simon Labanim. Where do we get the koach from? We got the koach from these children. Not from the tzaddikim, with the capital tzaddik. Not the gedolim, with the capital gimel. But from these little tzaddikim, these little gedolim, these children. Gave the koach, gave the spiritual energy and power to Jews throughout history to ask shilas, even in the most difficult circumstances. But then, I can't remember, a year or two ago, I saw a brief reference to a different perspective, which is in source number 10, a one-liner. This is from the Tshuvas Lahoros Nosan. I thank my dear friend, one of the young Rosh Yeshivas at YU, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, who many years ago exposed me to these beautiful svarim. Rav Nosan Gishtetner just passed away in the last few years. It was a big gadol in Bnei Brak. He wasn't involved in politics, so most people didn't hear of him. He just sat and learned and taught. He was a big, big gadol. His svarim are beautiful, brilliant. He was of Hungarian background. Just passed away. So sometime after the war, he was asked the shaila. You don't have the shaila on your sheet, source number 10, but I'll tell you what the shaila was. I don't believe the person who asked him was the one who was in the story. I think the person who asked him was a Holocaust survivor who was a Rav in America, who sent the shaila to Rav Nosson Gishtetner. And he was asked by a young adult, maybe middle-aged, the following. When he was, I don't know if it was either in the camps or one of the ghettos, there was some rule that they made, I think it was in the ghetto, about certain valuables that had to be confiscated, given away. But a lot of the Jews tried to hide them. At the time, they still thought that it would be helpful to them if they could hide these things, but then people got caught. So it was the Nazis, the Kapos, somebody, they made everyone into the town square, and they were going to make a lesson out of it. And they took some of the people, I'm not sure if it was just the people who got caught, or it was just Stam they took people, and they started beating them to death, viciously, mercilessly, like Titus HaRasha. One of the people they were beating to death, horrific torture, pain, you could hear the bones cracking, the blood is flying, was an old man whose son was witnessing the whole thing. And I guess, one way or another, the Kapos realized that this is the son. And the son was wearing a nice watch. Apparently the watch wasn't something that had to be given away. And the Kapos says to the son, listen to this carefully, I'll make you a deal. If you give me your watch, I'll shoot your father and he'll die right away. If not, you can watch. I'll finish the job slowly. Die he will. How is your choice? For the watch, a bullet to the head. If not, you can watch your father be beaten to death. What would you do? What's the right thing to do? The son gave the watch. And somehow, the son survived the war. But he didn't survive free of guilt. And he's plagued the rest of his life with what he did. Did he kill his father? So he asks the shaila, do I need kapara for what I did? This is the shaila. Asked to a rav who sent the shaila to Lahoros Nosson. So in Chelik Beis of Yoredeya, Tshuvas Lahoros Nosson, there's two or I think three lengthy tshuvas, all one after the other, dealing with the shaila. I don't want to discuss the answer today. Just look at the opening line as Nosson Gishtetner begins to answer the question. Source number 10. B'yom pakod Hashem Yizbarach Avon Oso Uma Harasha. When that day will come, and we have no doubt it will come, says Nosson Gishtetner, when HaKadosh Baruch will make that nation pay for their crimes, Yifkod Gam Avon Zeh, they'll also have to pay, Hashem will also call them to task for this sin. Now what sin do you think he means? You think this, what, that he tortured a boy? That he mercilessly killed a father? There were literally millions of acts of such torture. No, that's not what he's talking. That's for sure they have to give din v'cheshbon on. But that's not the chiddush of Nosson Gishtetner. What's the avon zeh? Ki hutzrachnu lizdakek l'sheila mein zu. They're going to have to give din v'cheshbon. They're going to get punished for making us ask questions like this. Who has to ask such questions? What horrific questions! That itself is a rishus, that they make us ask these questions. So it's not just the godless of the Jews that we see in the questions. It's the rishus of the enemy we see through the questions as well. And that's, I think about that every time I read this medrash. The children ask the shaila, can we do it? So not only will Titus get din v'cheshbon on the death of these children, the very fact that they had to ask such a question, children, he'll pay for that as well. And then the last point I want to mention is the most powerful. The Imo Anochi Batzara. Al Eila Ani, said HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ani Bochia. We mentioned this earlier, but I want to stress it now, just briefly. Hashem Ro'i Lo Echsar. We don't always feel him, but even when he seems far away, he's there. He was with that father and son in the ghetto, and the Medrash tells us he was with those children on the boat. Al Eila Ani Bochia. Now, why is that so important? In previous years and other places, I've given full hour-length shiurim on this topic. Many, many midrashim, many nuances about the idea of Imo Anochi Batzara. There's a lot to say on it, which we are not doing now. But the question after you get through all of the midrashim and the gemaras is, why is it so important? Why is it clearly important to Chazal? They repeat it countless times that we should know Imo Anochi Batzara, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in pain. So I think there's three answers to that question, but I'll mention to you one now. It's actually included in one of the pieces in the Sefer Esh Kodesh. And then, interesting pairing, I found it in one of the writings of Rav Lichtenstein. Now, I'll read to you a quote. This is for those who want to look this up. This is from the book Leaves of Faith, Volume 2. And Rav Lichtenstein makes the point in that essay, why is it so important, Imo Anochi Batzara? Why do you think? So says Rav Lichtenstein, and the Esh Kodesh makes a similar idea. Because when we know that Imo Anochi Batzara, he's with us, that's a comfort, that's a nechama. The only thing worse than suffering is suffering alone. When you have somebody, a loved one, a spouse, a child, a friend, a rabbi, kol shekin rabbonu shalom, even if they can't get rid of the problem, even if they can cure you, heal you, take away the pain, but just being with you, Imo Anochi Batzara, is a kind of a nechama, kind of a menucha. So Rav Lichtenstein makes that point, he elaborates on it, and then he ends with the following story. Some of you, or if you are Talmidim, maybe you heard this from him, I never heard it, but it's published here in the book. This is a quote. A neighbor of ours, this is when Rav Lichtenstein lived in Yerushalayim, a neighbor of ours, Leib Rachman, who lived through the Holocaust and wrote about it, was once asked by a pseudo-philosopher, guest, meaning the person who was about to ask us a very insulting question, was a guest of Mr. Rachman's, adding insult to injury. But no. People are Mishalim, Ra'at Tachastova all the time. So Leib Rachman, the Holocaust survivor, invites a person, a pseudo-philosopher, over to his house. And the philosopher, pseudo-philosopher, asks Leib Rachman where the Rabboni Shlom had been at the time of the Holocaust. Where was he? Looking her straight in the eye, Rav Lichtenstein writes, he responded calmly, Erez Gven mit uns. He was with us. Erez Gven mit uns. And as he repeated the story, Rav Lichtenstein concluded, one sensed how much that awareness, the awareness of that presence, had sustained him. Erez Gven mit uns. That's what the Beis Yisrael was asking Rabbi Lau's brother. In the chimneys, in the smoke, was he there? And the answer was yes. Erez Gven mit uns. In the chimneys, on the boat, in the bus bombings, in the knife attacks. We don't know why he allows it to happen, why he does what he does. That's the teku. But there is a tikkun if we realize Hashem Ro'i Lo Echsar. He's not far away. Erez Gvin mit uns. He's with us all the time. זכור את אשר עשה הצה בפנים, שלב חרבו, בא לפניי ולפנים. By the first line of the image of mothers eating their children, that didn't do enough for you. So then you have the step before, Im tevashelna rachmanios yaldehen. You have the vision of the mothers cooking their children. There are two shocking themes that are clearly repeated and therefore driven home in this kina. The first is the idea of all people, a mother. Cannibalism is horrific enough for us to conceive of. But a mother eating her children? A mother eating, cooking her children? And if that is not bad enough, I'll just mention the Gemara in Yuma, and Daf Lamed Ches. If you read the Gemara literally, it's not just that the mothers ate and cooked their children. The Gemara there says that the mothers killed their children. So we have so many stories. The Holocaust is certainly filled with them. Where we know of mothers just the opposite, so selflessly doing anything they could, giving up their lives. And yet, here it's the mother perhaps killing, cooking, eating the child. It's lo yuman. So that leads to the second point. My 7-year-old son, last night for the first time, made it through the whole Eicha in shul with me last night. So, in order to, he's pretty good on his own, but in order to help keep his attention, so at different points in Eicha, I would point out certain things. So, this he kind of saw on his own, and he asked me about. And he kept on asking me. You know, it was like the father-son shush thing at some point. He's usually a good boy, quiet in shul, but he couldn't stop asking me, why would they do this? He doesn't know about the killing part. But in Perek Bet, he couldn't understand why they were eating. And then in Perek Dalet, he couldn't understand why they're cooking. And he kept on asking me. So I don't really have a good answer, because there is no good answer. But what is the answer, the true answer, which is what I tried to tell him, but Baruch Hashem, he can't understand it, and hopefully he'll never understand it, is that what's the second theme of this kina? Hunger. Hunger. The horrific, horrific, halavai I would say numbing, but painful, grotesque ends to which hunger can drive a person. We still don't understand how the mothers could do it. We still lament over it. But even with the Tzarech Iyun, there's only one thing that could even partially explain it, and that's hunger. And that's the second theme. We often look at the end, not what happened while the Beis HaMikdash was under threat, but the destruction. Not what happened before, but the death. But the process is just as bad or worse. Before the death, there was the hunger. Imagine the siege and the hunger. As I said about my son, it should be for all of us, halavai for always. We actually can't understand it because we're fortunate. But if you've ever spoken to anyone, the hunger, whoever suffered from this, is just, we can actually appreciate what it says right before that second pasuk I mentioned. Tochal nashim periyaz perek beis im tevashelna rachmanios eldehen is perek dalid. What pasuk in Eicha? Perek dalid pasuk yud. What's the pasuk right before that? Perek dalet pasuk tet. Tovim hayu chalalei cherev mechalalei rav. The Navi tells us, we imagine, we'll get to it shortly, the Mises Meshuna of the Asura Haruge Malchus, Haruge Cherev, bombs, ball bearings, suicide blasts, oh, horrible. It's all better mechalei rav. There's nothing worse than hunger. 2 years ago, I was one of the madrasim on a group of seminary students who went to Poland for a week. And after that trip, I was so inspired that I took out and I reread the book Night by Elie Wiesel, which is an amazing book, totally mutter. You should read it if you have nothing else to do this afternoon. Definitely Tisha B'Av reading. But if you don't read it today, you should read it another time, because you should read it. So one of the most powerful stories in this book is on page 106, at least in my edition, where he writes about hunger. He tells a number of stories, but I'll give you this last one, because it's the closest I've ever seen to the Kina. He talks about how they were in the wagon cars on the way to the camps, and they were passing through town, some European town, and the people threw bread into the wagon cars. Pieces of bread. Now you think, why are the people throwing bread in? Maybe it was a Rachmanos, they felt bad. Maybe for some of them. But for some of them, it was sport. So they could get a glimpse or add a little extra torture. See, what happens when you take people who have been boxed up for days in a railway car and throw a little food in there? What happens? So, Elie Wiesel says the following. Just read you two unforgettable paragraphs. A piece fell into our wagon. I decided that I would not move. Anyway, I knew that I would never have the strength to fight with a dozen savage men. Not far away, I noticed an old man dragging himself along on all fours. He was trying to disengage himself from the struggle. He held one hand to his heart, and I thought at first he had received a blow to the chest. But then I understood. He had a bit of bread under his shirt. With remarkable speed, he drew it out and he put it to his mouth. His eyes gleamed, a smile like a grimace lit up his face. And then it was immediately extinguished. A shadow had just loomed up near him. The shadow threw itself upon him, fell to the ground, stunned with blows. The old man cried, "Mayor! Mayor, my dear boy! Don't you recognize me? I'm your father. You're hurting me. You're killing your father. I've got some bread for you too, for you too." And then he collapsed. His fist was still clenched around the small piece that he had tried to carry to his mouth. But the other one, the son, Mayor, threw himself upon it, pried it out of the dead man's hands, and carried it to his mouth. The old man again whispered something, let out a rattle, and died amid the general indifference. His son searched him, took the bread, and began to devour it. He was not able to get very far. Two men had seen and hurled themselves upon him. Others joined in. And when they withdrew, next to me were two corpses, side by side, the father and the son. I was 15 years old. See, here we have the inverse of the Kina. Slightly more understandable than the Kina, but still inscrutable. The Kina talks about mothers killing their children for food. And here we have a story of a son killing his father. They're both unimaginable to us. And they're both directly and only the result of the ra'av. The ra'av that was in the Churban, which the Kina talks about, that Eicha speaks about, and the ra'av that was experienced most recently in the Holocaust. Ali Yirshitzaris. Zen in Ain Grace at Sarah. Him to Halna Nashim Periyana Malay Tipuchim Alalaili. Clear and dramatic time. We have Tzidah Kadin. Lacha Hashem at Sadaka, Balona Boshes Apanim. We could ask all the questions, but in the end, we know the truth. Lacha Hashem at Sadaka. Hashem is righteous. Balona Boshes Apanim. We deserve what we got. It's a very powerful contrast, and it's not just the style, but more important is the theology, or the hashkafa, the machshava, which is being communicated. Here we have actually 11 answers. Actually, the previous kina, which we're not saying, but the end of Yud Ches, starts with Atat Tzadik. We begin the process of Tzidik Hadin. If you look towards the end, we have some particular examples. We mentioned Ba'achan Asher Ma'al Bacherem, the Me'ila that took place. Or the next one, Tselem Micha, Pesal Micha, what happened in Nov and Gibbon, different things. When we say Hashem, we know the truth at the end of the day. L'cha Hashem Atztaka, V'lonu, Boshes HaPanim. I think, who's the Lanu? Who's the Lanu? So I think the Lanu is each of us individually. Now, that may sound obvious to you. Who else would Lanu be? So I'll tell you who else it might be. Maybe it's the Gedolim. Maybe it's the Nevi'im. Right? They know the truth. They told us, they warned us, the Eini Ha'eda. So there is truth to that, of course. But I actually saw something amazing this year, which I think perhaps gets even to something more powerful. The Gemara says, it's not on your sheet, but the Gemara says, a very famous Gemara in Nedarim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked Chachamim, the Nevi'im, everybody, what happened? Why was there a Chorban? And nobody knew an answer until HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself said, Shalo Baruch Hu Batorah Tchila. That they didn't make Birchos HaTorah. They learned, but they weren't making the Birchos. Dabar Zeh Shalu, L'Chachamim, L'Nevi'im, etc. No one knew the answer until HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself said, Lo Baruch Hu Batorah Tchila. So there's a lot to say about this Gemara, obviously. How do you relate this Gemara to the other Gemaras in Yuma and other places about the Chorban? Hayitachein, Shagas Aryeh, he actually asked the question in a halachic context. Could it be that not making Birchas HaTorah, that's an Avera that deserves the Chorban? None of that's for now. But I saw, there's a Sefer I have at home, I don't remember the name, but the author, I believe, is quoting first person that he heard this directly, the following question and answer from Rav Shach. Rav Shach asked the following question, which certainly never dawned on me all the times I learned this Gemara. How is it possible that the people are held accountable and they're punished for this Avera? After all, even the Nevi'im didn't know the answer. Even the Chachamim didn't know the answer. Now, if the Chachamim didn't know the answer, if the Nevi'im didn't know the answer, what comes out? Were the Nevi'im warning, you know, you better say Berachas HaTorah? Obviously not, the Nevi'im didn't know about the problem. Were the Chachamim having a kinos tshuva on Birkas HaTorah? Were the Yemei Iyun? Were the Yarchei Kalas? Were there Kol Koreis? All about the Avon Gadol Vahamar of Birkas HaTorah? Obviously not. Because Shalu, Davar Zela, Chachamim, Nevi'im, and nobody knew about it. So if none of that happened, asked Rav Shach, if the leaders didn't know, if the leaders didn't rebuke, if the leaders didn't correct, so how could you blame the people? How could it be? Al-Avon Zeh, Charev Beis Elokeinu. So says Rav Shach, you're forced to reach the following simple, but obvious, and at least from his perspective, he thinks this is radical. He says that Rav Shach, right in the footnote, he says that Rav Shach said, when I realized this answer, the walls of the house shook. That's how he felt. He was so shocked that he came to this realization. So Rav Shach, you see from this Gemara the inescapable conclusion that in the end, whatever the Chachamim know or don't know, whatever even Nevi'im know or don't know, people know the truth. You know the truth. You don't need a Navi to tell you. You don't need a Gadol to tell you. You don't need a Kinus. You don't need a Kol Korei. You just have to be honest with yourself. Now, we are often not honest with ourselves, which is why it would be nice to have Nevi'im, and hopefully we have good Chachamim to help us. But says Rav Shach, you see from this, in the end, a person is responsible for himself. It's not the Gadol's responsibility. It's not this one's responsibility. It's not even a Navi's responsibility. They didn't know about the Berachas HaTorah. You know what you're doing wrong. Your spouse might not know. Your best friend might not know. Maybe they do know, but maybe they don't. but you know. You just have to do that incredibly difficult and painful job of being honest with yourself. But you know, and therefore, you're responsible. Don't look to blame somebody else. But the Navi didn't say, but the Navi did say. The Chachamim did say, the Chachamim didn't say. We're so upset about Sinas Chinam. Don't look to other people. Maybe they're doing wrong, maybe they're doing right. But just look at yourself. Really, you could do a Cheshbon and Nefesh that you're 100% your Eis Kalten and Sinas Chinam and Avas Yisrael? If so, then you can start looking at other people. But you don't need anyone to tell you. You don't need anyone to help. You know the truth. Beram l'chavero, beram l'makom, beram l'atzmo. It's nice to have a shir. It's nice to read a good sefer. It's nice to hear a good shir on the internet. It's nice to go to a good shir in person. But in the end, everyone knows. You know the truth. Better than any chacham, any navi, any rav. You know the truth. And therefore you're responsible. V'lonu ba'oshes ha'panim. Lanu, we don't, not the Rav, not the Navi, not the Chacham, Lanu, us, Boshes upon him. Because we know the truth. And that truth is, Lacha Hashem Atztaka. Hashem Atztaka, Bosa Tashir, Lezam, Yavata, Lanu, Boshes upon him. See what we mean, this is undoubtedly true. Is someone who's willing to give their life up for Hashem. Whether it's the Gimel Averos, the Big Three, or the Gemara says, it could be Befarhesya, even if it's not the Big Three, or it could be, as it was the time of the Tanoim, in a Shas HaShmad, then it could be anything, perhaps even for a Minug, certainly for a Din. So think about that for a minute. Are you willing to die for Hashem? Are you willing to die for the mitzvot, for the Torah? So if the answer is yes, that's Al Kiddush Hashem. That's a Mesiras Nefesh. It takes a great tzaddik to be willing to do that, no doubt. But there's another type of dying that is also Kiddush Hashem. There's another type of hero that we have, not just the type like the Haruya Malchus, clearly tzaddikim, clearly kedoshim, clearly heroes. But there's another type of hero, there's another type of Kiddush Hashem which I think we don't appreciate enough. Perhaps now, more than ever, maybe it should be stressed. And it's idea that's mentioned in the Sefer Esh Kodesh on source 14 on your sheet. I won't read the whole thing inside, but I will paraphrase. He quotes this, I think it's a tradition from his father. Just reading the underlined relevant section. Hamoser nafsho ba'ad Yisrael, gorol hu min hamoser nafsho ba'ad Hashem levad. An astounding statement. Someone who gives up his life on behalf of his fellow Jew, is a greater kadosh than someone who dies for Hashem. Dying in defense of the Jewish people, or even just a fellow Jew, is death al kiddush Hashem of a greater level, of a higher magnitude, than Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Shimon, etc., than someone who just died for Hashem's sake. Where do you get off saying such a thing? It sounds radical. Yeah. Maybe. But the Esh Kodesh proves it by a simple mashal. It says, the person who's willing to die for Hashem, the Big Three, it's Shas HaShmad, that's like that secret service agent who's willing to take a bullet. He's willing to die for the king, willing to die for the president. Now, it's one thing to pay lip service, but it's another thing to do it. That's a hero, no question about it. But says the Esh Kodesh, even bigger, who demonstrates his love for the king even more? The one who's willing to take a bullet for the king's son. I love the king so much, I'm not only willing to die for him, I'll die for his children. Isn't that intuitively a greater act of self-sacrifice? A greater act of dedication to the king? In other words, it's only a chiddush, it's only perplexing what the Esh Kodesh says until you realize that dying for a Jew is the ultimate testament of dying for Hashem. Why do we die for our fellow Jew? Because he too is our brother and sister, a fellow child of Hashem, a banim lamakom. So where do we show our greatest love of Hashem, says the Esh Kodesh? not when we die for Hashem, but even greater is if we die for His people. Now there can be many, many circumstances in Israel and abroad where someone is moser nefesh for a fellow Jew, undoubtedly. But what's the most dramatic and relevant example nowadays, of course? Tzahal. We speak about their willingness to be moser nefesh, and Baruch Hashem, the overwhelming, overwhelming majority are just willing. But there as have always been, and until the Giladi comes, there will be those who are willing to give up their life, and not just willing, but actually do, and actually have. And I wouldn't say it, but the Esh Kodesh did. That's a greater act of Kiddush Hashem than one who gives up his life like Rabbi Akiva did for Hashem. Quick story, which some of you may have heard, but it's the kind of story that deserves to be repeated, so I'll repeat it even if you've heard it. Because it wasn't just the Esh Kodesh, but more recently the exact same idea was said by, who knows the story I'm thinking about? The great Gaon, Rav Gustman, Zatzal. Rav Gustman himself was a Holocaust survivor. His survival is an incredible story, but not for now. But when he came to Rechavia after he made Aliyah, he gave a famous Shir Kloli, which had many of the Chachmei Yerushalayim, Talmidim from many different yeshivas, came to hear the shir, and learned professionals came to hear the shir. And one of the professionals who regularly came to Rav Gusman's shir, and that's Netzach Yisrael in Rechavia, they recently refurbished the building, but it's still there, was Professor Yisrael Alman. Wasn't as famous then as he is now. He had a son, I stress the word had, who was a boger of Yeshivat Shalavim. Anyone like me who went to Shalavim knows the Alman Institute, was called up on reserves in 1982 in the first Lebanon War, and he was killed al Kiddush Hashem during that war. 1982, Shlomo Alman, Hashem Yim Kam Damo, was killed in battle. Rav Gustman went with some Talmidim to the funeral, and after the funeral, you know that's not usually when you pay a shiva call, right after a funeral, Rav Gustman went to the house. Professor Alman was shocked and honored by his visit, and then Rav Gustman told him the following. He says, most people don't know, he has a daughter, has a son-in-law who took over, runs the yeshiva, the shul now. Because most people don't know, I had a son. My son was named Meir. I was holding him, literally, I was holding him, said Rav Gustman, when he was ripped from my hands and murdered right in front of me. Where is my Meir now? Where has he been since he was killed? Says Rav Gustman, there's a special minyan in heaven for people who die al Kiddush Hashem. My son Meir is with all of the other millions of Kedoshim in that minyan. But you know what they're doing today? They're welcoming your son Shlomo. But the difference is, said Rav Gustman, my son davens in the minyan. Your son is going to be the chazan of the minyan. And my son Meir is going to tell your son Shlomo, I died because I was a Jew. You, Shlomo, you died defending the Jewish people. Said Rav Gustman now, talking to Professor Alman, my Meir is a kadosh. He is holy. But your Shlomo, he is the shliach tzibor for the kedoshim. Ali Yiddish Atzaras, Zenin Ein Grais Atzara. Arzela Banona Dira Torah, Bale, Trisin, Vimishno, Vigimara. Let's skip now to Kina Chav Gimel. This Kina is based on the Medrash and the Gemara in Gittin about the two children, the children of Yishmael Kohen Gadol. He has already been killed, and his two children, the orphan children, are sold into slavery. Apparently they were both very good looking, and their respective masters decided, what better than to have their children produce progeny? That's what all slave owners did. Well, they were talking to each other. You're not going to believe the great Jewish kid that I bought. Oh, she is beautiful. You're not going to believe the great Jewish slave that I bought. He is so handsome. They had an Einfalt. Why don't we mate them? And we can really produce beautiful new slaves. So they put them in a dark room. Agav, you see the depravity. They assumed that if two people would be in a room, they wouldn't sleep separately. That's just an assumption. That tells you all you need to know about their culture. They assumed that two strangers left in a room, Mustama, they'll cohabit. But, as the Medrash and the Gemara and the Kina describe so powerfully, each one said to themselves, how could I do it? If you turn the page towards the middle, a little after the middle of the Kina, we read, Nin Aron, Eich L'Shivcha Yihinosei. The boy said to himself, a great grandchild of Aaron HaKohen, son of the Kohen Gadol, with Yichus, I should do this with a Shivcha, with a slave girl. She said the same thing. Bas Yocheved, Eich L'Evet Yinosei. It's a pasnisht. It's not for us, it's beneath us. And they didn't do it, and they stayed on their separate corners of the room the whole night until it got dark. When they woke up, and this was in the morning, when the light came into the room, they saw that, in fact, something they had not previously realized, was brother and sister. And the kina at the end, second to last stanza, or boker, zebezeh, kihikiru, they recognize each other, hoyochi, hoyochos. What happened, says the kina, nischabku, yachab, nischabru, they hugged each other, they kissed each other, they hugged so tight, ad yatsasa nishmasam benishima, and they died together, al kiddush Hashem. A lot to say about this kina. The hour is getting late, so I won't belabor it. If there are future years where we're together, so then we have other things. There's other things to say about this kina. But I'll just mention now the idea of children. We alluded to it briefly on the kina with the boats, but there we more spoke about the Mesiras Nefesh and other aspects of it. But this is not the first time, but perhaps the most... This is a kina all about the death of two children. So much to say about it, much to say about it. Who they were, all sorts of things. But just now mention that one of the things that we mourn on Tisha B'Av, for the Churban, and throughout Jewish history, not just the death of so many Jews, but specifically the death of children. If your Mekayim Nefesh Achas is Kemekayim Olam Molei, so what do you say about Bekayim being the nefesh of a child? And of course the opposite is equally true. If to kill one person is to destroy a whole world, so what do you say about the death of children? These were not famous. Maybe they would have grown up, they would have become famous. Maybe they would have done something. But we have no record of them doing anything impressive yet. The only thing we know about them is their yichus, and that they were children, and this one act of discipline, self-control. But that's enough. And the death of children does and should strike us differently than when we think of adults. There's a famous quote attributed to the Panovitcher Rav, who, as we know, was one of the most famous and celebrated survivors, used the pain of his survival to fuel all of his energy, unceasing energy, to rebuild Torah and Eretz Yisrael and the world. Panovitcher Rav, who also suffered terribly for his own family, made the following observation very famously. Used to say that a child without parents is an orphan, but a generation without children is eichid, an orphan. There could be a dor yosom. Dor yosom is a generation without children. The generation of survivors is virtually a generation without children. That's why Rabbi Lau's survival was so celebrated and so miraculous. Because children, as a rule, didn't survive. How could they? If the hunger and disease didn't get them, they certainly were no use to the Nazis. They were often killed first. So that generation, that Sheres HaPleita, contained almost no children. It was a Dor Yosom. not because of all the parents and grandparents that were killed, that too, because it was a generation without children. Children represent the future of a person, the future of a family, and the future of an am. A generation without children is a generation that has its future at risk. Part of the godless of that generation was that nevertheless they rebuilt, and they had many people lost their families and started over. They had more children. But the death of children, not only on the personal tragic level for the family, but for the am, is something especially, especially powerful. Remember years ago I heard on a tape from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, so his father was a survivor. And he said he went years, I guess he survived, and then he hung out in, I guess he emigrated to Brooklyn with, just hung out with other survivors. And there were years of his life where he didn't see any children. After a short while, once they were in the camps, no children left. And when they first emigrated to the States, no one had any children. And he said he remembers as his child, even to after, years later, every time his father saw a Jewish child, not only his own, any child, how affected he was emotionally from this, just to see Yiddishe Kinder. I think they say the same thing about Rav Gustman, the same Rav Gustman we mentioned before, that he used to go out and watch parades and things like that in Yerushalayim. They said, your mamish from the Gedolei Hador, you're going to watch kids waving flags, the Rikud de Galim, and this kind of stuff. Parents sometimes think it's silly. So he said, if you saw what I saw, you know, to see Jewish children happy in Eretz Yisrael, this is not a small thing. So this kina is not only about these two children, but it's about all the children during the Churban, during the Holocaust, before and after, who had no future and whose death threatened our future. Which also gives much information, but this kina and the texts which support it was written by Rav Kalonymus, who was descendant of those who were killed in the Crusades already in the 11th century, very, very old. And it discusses, in particular, the three famous communities, the Kilos Shum, that were killed in the Rhine Valley from Germany. Without getting into the details, and I'm not a historian anyway, but you know the basic story of the Crusades, when the Pope called for Mechemes Mitzvah, they should go and liberate the Holy Land from the infidels. The infidels were the Muslims. They were here in Eretz Yisrael. They ruled Yerushalayim at the time. And whether it was from the Pope himself or the people on their own, one way or another, it took about 3 years to get from France to Israel in those days. And they figured, why should they have to wait 3 years to fulfill the mitzvah of killing infidels if they have infidels or even bigger infidels right next door to them? So it took a detour into Germany. And they figured they don't need to wait 3 years to kill infidel Muslims. They could kill infidel Jews. It's a bigger mitzvah even, and it's closer. And that's the story of the Crusades. So we have here in this very detailed and historical crusade, if you look on the fourth paragraph, you see Akonein Mar al Harugei Ashpira. So you have the reference to Spire. The next one, Kahal Vermaiza. Then right after that, Al Direk Kahal Magensa. You have the dates. We know the dates. Again, the date that they came, the date they left. We have some historical reference even. And one point to mention, which is very crucial here, is when you look at the dates, the kina itself gives us the dates. So what is the date not? It's not Tisha B'Av. The dates are not Tisha B'Av. It's not one of those things where someone's going to discover, that, oh, you see the Crusades, it really happened on Tisha B'Av. Another one to add to the list, it's in the codes. The Bible codes will say Crusades and Tisha B'Av. No, nothing to do with it. So what is it doing in the kinos? Why do we write a kina? Why is it in the kinos? Why do we say it? So Rav Soloveitchik, and at the same time, a bit before him, his uncle, the Grizz, was famous for this as well. They said the answer to this is in the kina itself at the end. Not the end, excuse me, towards the middle. Two paragraphs after the one about Magensa. The paragraph beginning, Simuna al Levavchem. And this was not only what the Rav said was the answer to why the kina is said on Tisha B'Av, but it was what the Rav used to say many, many times, which is the reason that he was against the establishment of Yom HaShoah. Because the kina says, V'chi ein lahosif moed shever v'savera. Right? Why didn't we have those other dates as days to commemorate the Crusades? The answer is, right, medieval, we're talking about great Rishonim, the greatest Rishonim. They didn't make a special day for the Crusades. They used Tisha B'Av as the day to mourn for the Crusades. And they told us why, V'chi ein lahosif moed shever v'savera. So I don't want to remotely get into the issue now of Yom HaShoah. Many of us here or from the States are from or part of communities that do commemorate Yom HaShoah. Is there a difference between a day of commemoration and a day of Avelus, which is what the Rav was against? I think yes, but it's not now for a discussion at all about what has happened or not happened to Yom HaShoah. For those who are interested, a number of years ago in Tradition magazine, or by J.J. Schachter, wrote a very, very lengthy and well-sourced article all about the sugya. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein has written about the sugya and the influence of his father, and the fact in Eretz Yisrael they adopted Yom HaShoah and didn't go with what the Rav told the Prime Minister. It's a complicated sugya. But whatever one should or shouldn't do on Yom HaShoah, one thing you should do, and we have been doing the whole morning, is using Tisha B'Av to speak about not only the Holocaust and the Crusades and other tragedies. And as we said in the beginning, we're not doing it as a distraction, as a mechanism, as a tool to help make the day relevant, although it does that. We're doing it out of a belief, a deep belief, that these things are all connected to this. The Rav stressed this in many ways, and I saw also recently, or numerous times actually, the point made out of a very famous Medrash as well. If you take a look at the Medrash Eicha in Source 15, the hour is getting late, I don't want to read the whole thing inside, but Source 15 tells the story of Rabbi Gamliel, who had a neighbor, who was a woman who Nebuch had a child who died, had a son who died. Rachmana Litzlan. And this woman used to cry all night. She couldn't get over it. She was devastated, understandably so, crying and crying and crying over her son. So the Medrash tells us that each time when Rabbi Gamliel heard this, Hayanizkar Churban Nebesa Mikdash, Vahaya Bocha Ima, he would cry with her. But the Medrash tells us he wasn't crying over her son. He was inspired by her cries for her son to cry over the Beis HaMikdash. And he wasn't just crying, the Medrash tells us. He cried so much until his eyelashes came out. His eyebrows, eyelashes, they came out. It was so bad that Talmidim thought that he was physically getting sick and maybe could have been worse, that the Talmidim were Megaresh from the neighborhood. I assume and I hope they did it with respect and they helped her move and they carried her stuff. I assume it wasn't a Girush the way sometimes we're familiar with, I hope. But for Rabbi Gamliel's sake, it was just not healthy. So the Shaila, which I think many have asked, I've seen this, I think in the name of numerous people, but this year I saw it in particular in the name of Rav Mordechai Gifter Zatzal. So he made the point, and maybe the Rav said this too, I don't recall, maybe others, but Rav Gifter for sure said, what's the connection? A mother's crying over her son, you cry with her over the son. And Rav Gamliel was certainly an empathetic, sympathetic person. But the Medrash says, no, it triggered in his mind the tears for the Churban. So was he callous? He's so frum, the way, you know, some people might think this is very frum that he did it. He's so above anything earthly, he's crying for the... I don't think we would really say this. A true Baal Musar would say if that was the case, that there's something felt in the Benam Lechavero, there's a Chisara if that's the case. That can't be the Pshat. So instead of Gifta, no. He, of course, is crying for her loss. But what he's teaching us is what's the Shoresh of her loss? The Churban HaBayis. It all comes from that. We make the mistake, we're davening so much as we should for Rafa'enu and Parnassa and things like that. But we don't daven enough for Sechazana, Samach David, Vel Yerushalayim. If we'd have all those, Memela, we'd have the Parnassa, we'd have the Rafua. That's what Rabban Gamliel was teaching us. He wanted her to have a Nechama. So how do you have a Nechama? You cry over the Churban, there should be a Geula, there should be a Mashiach. The Giladi should come, she'll have a Nechama. Allah Yiddish Tzaris and an Ein Grace Tzara. That's the key. That's the message. Kinachavei. Kimitin Roshi Mayim Veni Mekor Nozalai Bekwea Koyim Asai Velelai Eschalai Tapai Vololai Yekolai And Vein Shavu Meretz Oyev, they'll come back. V'yesh Tikva L'achrisei Chanum Hashem V'shavu Banim L'gvulam. So I just want to highlight, especially in light of the Medrash, the special koach of the power of the tefillah of mothers. This is a foil to the previous kina about the depravity that mothers unfortunately sunk to. But what we're hopefully much more familiar with, and what has been much more a consistent mainstay of Jewish history, is the Yiddish Shemama, not only the Ima Rachel or the Mama Rachel, but all Jewish mothers who have that unique and powerful love for children. But what I want to stress, what you see in the Medrash, it's not just the love that a Jewish mother has, which can be uniquely powerful, but the koach of a Jewish mother. The tfilos of a Jewish mother are incomparable to anything else. Nebuch, over the years, sometimes if somebody was in a certain tzara, especially when they were sick, will speak to me what to do, ask me, ask the rabbi, to daven for them. And of course, the answer is always yes, as a community, individually. Of course, we should be davening for people. But I always tell people, based on much earlier sources than myself, but the most powerful thing is for you to daven for yourself. The chole, him or herself, is the most powerful. So I will just add, and the second most powerful thing, your mother. A Jewish mother, the koach of her tfilos, of Rachel Imenu, this is what worked here. There's no one else who can touch the mother. That's what happened. Even HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you could turn down Moshe, to an Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, not Rachel. So in that vein, I just share with you a quick, very powerful, beautiful story I heard years ago on a tape from Rav Matisyahu Solomon, who's of course gained fame as the Mashkiach in Lakewood, but before that he was the Mashkiach in Gateshead in England. And he told the following story from the time he was in England. So there was a boy in the yeshiva, was a nice, solid boy, a good learner, serious, but far from the best guy in the yeshiva. And yet, it would stoop, it would stun Rav Matisyahu and the other Ramim in the yeshiva. Every Zman, without fail, the boy got, as a Chavrusa, the best guy. A different best guy. Couldn't understand it. Because it wasn't the best Chavrusa, which is why that Chavrusa would usually move on. But then, sure enough, wouldn't you believe it, the next Zman, he got another super-duper guy better than him. I never understood how come he was Zochet to always have the best Chavrusa. So he said one year, I think it was sometime in Elul, maybe it was after Maariv, or Matisyahu said he was going back to his office, and he sees the boy on a payphone. For the younger people in the room, there used to be such a thing called a payphone. So the boy was calling home, like we used to do maybe once a week, at the payphone. So he sees the boy, and as he's walking by, not trying to eavesdrop, he overhears the following sentence. He says, here's the boy saying to his mother, Mommy, it's okay. You could stop davening now. I found a chavrusa. What a story. Mommy, you could stop davening. I found the chavrusa. That's Mama Rachel. That's this medrash. That's this kina. So, those of us who aren't Jewish mothers, we do our best. But the Jewish mothers among us, please, we're counting on you. Daven for us. We sure need it. We skip now to Kina Lamed Aleph. That's 31, Kina Lamed Aleph. It's a very famous Kina. Contrasting Betzesi Mi Mitzrayim on that famous night when we had Mitzrayim, and then that infamous night, Betzesi Mi Yerushalayim. In many communities, certainly in the States, there's a minhag to sing this Kina. I'm going to do my best to start the tune, but most days I don't have a great voice. Today, Kol Shekein. So those of you who are familiar with the tune, please help me out. But before we sing this kina together, just to point out a brief but powerful vort. What's the point of the contrast? Betzesi and Betzesi. So the simple understanding is something we mentioned before, the highs and the lows. It makes it more powerful, more relevant, more emotive. But it's not just emotional. I think it's theological, hashkafic as well, philosophical. The Sifsei Chaim, Rav Chaim Friedlander, in his volume on Tisha B'Av, connects us to a Gemara in Chagiga. It's on your sheet. The Gemara talks about Rebbe, how he was reading Kinos, and he got to the line, which is in Eicha and Perek Beis, Pasuk Aleph, Ki Shliach Mishamayim Eretz. What does it say? He was so shocked by that line, says the Gemara, the Kinos, whatever he was reading, the Eicha, I mean, fell from his hands. Amar, and he said, Me'igra Ram, Labira Amikta. He went from such a high tower to a low valley. So, the contrast, the power, the emotion, the human drama. But, sure enough, if you take a look at the Rashi in Eicha on that Pasuk, verse 17, Rashi makes the following point. After they were so high, Now Hishlichem Eretz, Hashem threw us down. Bevasachas, adds Rashi. That's not in the Gemara. Bevasachas, v'lo ma'at ma'at. Then Rashi adds, me'ir b'rama, the bira mikta. So, says Rav Friedlander in the Sifsei Chaim, what's the stress with ma'at ma'at? Miyad, if you mean that, la'alat. What the Kina is trying to tell us, what we see from this Rashi in the Pasuk in Eicha, is that there's nothing in between for the Jews. Vayidin, you would say, it's all or nothing. Our highs are the highest of the high, and our lows are the lowest of the low. Anything incredible happening in society, even secular society, anything incredible, you can usually find Jewish leaders and influencers. Any really horrible, horrific, terrible, immoral, heretical social movement in society, you'll find Jews there too, unfortunately. Always. And nationally, it's certainly true. Either we're the highest of the high or the lowest of low. There is no middle for the Jews. It's either B'tzei Simi Mitzrayim or B'tzei Simi Yerushalayim. It's all or nothing. I'll just add one little quote, amazing. There's a well-known writer, Jewish, but not observant, strictly speaking, yet, named Jeffrey Goldberg, very big writer, writes for The Atlantic. So five years ago, he had the following quote. Said, Philo-Semites are anti-Semites who like Jews. There? I can repeat that. Philo-Semites are anti-Semites who like Jews. Now, I never asked him exactly what he meant, but what I think he meant is what Rashi said, is what the Sifsei Chaim said. What does that mean to be a Philo-Semite? I mentioned before, that's not like we earned it. That's an exaggerated focus and love of Jews. So that's the same thing as an anti-Semite. Meaning, because they both realize the Jews are different. The anti-Semite hates us for our differences. And the Philo-Semite, and there are some, love us, respect us for our differences. But it's the same thing. They get it. They get it. We're different. The biggest problem throughout history is that Jews are usually the last to get it. If we would just know what our enemies know, let alone our admirers, we'd be in much better shape. It's either one or the other. We're different. The usual rules don't apply to us. A usual nation that falls is la'at la'at. Says Rashi, that's not what happened. Hishliach mishamayim la'aretz. It's all or nothing for us. We're either in the shamayim or down on the ground. Either we're in the bira rama or the igra rama or the bira mikta. It's strange. I don't have an explanation. But at least we should know it. We should incorporate it. Eish to God be kirbi bahalo salibi pitsei simi mitzrayim bikini moira liman askira pitsei simi rushalayim Az yashir Moshe shir lo yinashe pitsei simi mitzrayim. After the Chorban, imagine. If we have to meet again a different year, another year, maybe we'll speak about the notion of survivor's guilt. That's not for today. But imagine what the Navi felt. Imagine. The captain who survived when his ship didn't. Comes back to Yerushalayim. It's bad enough. And the Navi, the Medrash describes graphically what did he find on the mountains and the hills of Yerushalayim. Etzpaos, Mukuta'in, Mushlochin, Baharim. Hands, butchered body parts, just littering the mountaintops, the hills of Yerushalayim, just left there like animal carcasses, not buried, nothing. And the Medrash describes how he gathered them up, umachabkan, umanashkan, v'nosnan letoch taliso. He hugged them. Imagine the image, the Navi, hugging, kissing, caressing these body parts. He takes them into his talis and left unsaid but obvious is that he then buried those body parts. In the middle of the war, the Holocaust, when the word finally got to Eretz Yisrael, just how bad it was, there was a tremendous kinus held by the Chevron Yeshiva. Rabbi Cheskel Sarna, the then Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron, spoke. This is not a well-known speech at all. Story for another time, how B'Hashkacha Pratis, I got hold of a copy of the speech. I was looking for it in a primary source. Couldn't find it anywhere. I asked people that I knew who had learned in the Chevron, people who were close with the Chaskel Sarner from the previous generation. I went through all of the Luyos Yecheskel, nothing. So the person who uncovered it is a professor who found it in the stacks in a library here in Israel, but it's certainly authentic. And it's a very, very powerful drasha. But one of the things that Chazkel Sarna said, maybe to some people it sounds controversial now, but it certainly wasn't controversial to Reb Chazkel Sarna or at the time, was how much worse the Holocaust was than anything else. Don't pretend the Holocaust is just another thing. The Holocaust is sui generis, it's unique, it's not like anything else. And one of the reasons that Reb Chazkel Sarna gave, very unapologetically, again, as I say, it was unsubconsciously, it wasn't a controversial thing to say at all, it was obvious to him. But one of the things he said is he quoted this medrash. He says, at least in the Churban, as bad as the Churban was, eventually those body parts got kfura. But with the Holocaust, the 6 million, where were they buried? Nowhere. Certainly nowhere that we know. Kfuras Yisrael, Kavod Achron. If they weren't ashes, they were in a mass grave in some forest. At least by the Churban, they had a Navi to come kiss them and bury them with love and give them the respect they deserved. The Holocaust, we had nothing. And Yaffa Eliach's incredible work of Tales of the Holocaust, another mutter and highly recommended Tisha B'Av book for reading. So she has a story on page 197. It's hard to say what's the most powerful story in the book, but this is one of them. It's not even about the Holocaust, it's after the Holocaust. Some of you may know that Rav Schneer Cutler, who was the successor and son of Rav Aaron Cutler, had a son who died. His eldest son, Rav Meir, was already married, but he died as a young man. So when Rav Schneer Cutler was sitting Shiva, horrific, horrific story, he's sitting Shiva for his young adult son. Tons of people there, but no one knows what to say, of course. The Blue Shiva Rebbe, who is, if you're familiar, you know, is the star of Yaffa Eliach's book, he comes and he makes the Shiva call. And she describes how the room split into two, like Kriyas Yamsuf. He comes in and he sits in front. And he goes up to Reb Schneer and he says the following. Imagine, you have to be the Blue Shiva Rebbe to say this. You're going to Reb Schneer Cutler at the Shiva for his son. Opening words. I envy you, Reb Schneer. I envy you. Your son passed away, yet he left a young wife and a child to carry his name. You know the place where your wife and child, you know the place where your son is buried. God blessed you with other children. So many people are here to comfort you in your sorrow. Said the Rebbe, I had one daughter whose face brightened the world, and a son-in-law who was a most promising young scholar and a grandchild, the delight of my heart. And then came the Holocaust. I don't even know the day they were murdered, the site of their graves, or if they even have one at all. No one came to comfort me because we were all being murdered. How can I not envy you? Concluded to Reb Schneer, you should know people are here, we're with you, and I beg of you, please be strong. For in a strange way, you are privileged. I envy you, and you're privileged as you sit Shiva for your son. Only the Blue Shiva Rebbe could say such a thing. And in the postscript to the story, a few days after he got up from Shiva, Reb Schneer called the Blue Shiva Rebbe, and he thanked him for giving him courage and strength. It's the only way he got through Shiva. Was from that message of the Blue Shiva Rebbe. This is exactly what Reb Chazkel Sarna said about the Holocaust in general. This is exactly what we speak about in the Kina, and in the Eicha, and the Eicha Rabbah. And it's also what we're going to think about now in this last Kina. 6 million Kedoshim. Some people think they know the art side, some people do Asara B'Teves, some people do Tisha B'Av. No Matseva, no yard side, no Shiva, no Nechama. Just a shavas, a disappearing of a world, and the disappearing of 6 million lives. Kina 48, at least in my book, the Kina of the Bab of Rebbe for the Holocaust. It's actually brought down, Berke Yosef and other Svarim, to end the day with in the afternoon, which we're approaching in essence, with words of Nechama. So just very briefly, Elit Zion v'areha k'mo isha b'tzireha. The Kedushas Levi of Levi Yisrael Berdichev said, why do we hope? It's a prayer, not just a comparison. It's a prayer. We hope to be like an isha b'tzireha in labor pains. So he said, because we hope, like a woman in labor hopes, that soon it will be over. I guess the soon part is easier for a man to say, but we hope for everyone that just like that led to something good, and we know an end is coming when a woman's in labor, so too we say, so what is the Nachama after all that we've been talking about? Centuries and centuries of death and destruction, dispersion and diaspora. What is the Nachama? There aren't many. But I think the best is one that is in a number of Mefarshim. I recently found it actually, perhaps even earliest, in the Chovas HaLevavos. But it's most famous for a comment made by Rav Yaakov Emden in his Siddur, which is the last source on your sheet. I won't read the whole thing inside, just the key line. But he compares the Jewish nation to all other nations in the world. This is before Mark Twain even. And he speaks about the survival of the Jews. How is it possible, he says, Misha Yayin b'yichud in Yanenu ma'amadenu ba'olam. You look at what happened, we're so unique in the world. We're the Ummah that's Gola, that's Pazura. There's no nation in the world that's near Defes Katmonu like us. How many people, we've had so many Tsarenu, so many people have tried, yet they're not able of Denu, Chalosenu, they can't destroy us. As he says, again, some of us know this from Mark Twain, but Rabbi Yaakov Emden said it in Lashon HaKodesh, line 4. Kola Umos, Hakadumos, Hatsumos, Abed Zichram, right, all those mighty nations before us, they're gone. And we are left. So here's the key line. This is what he's most famous for, if you skip down to the next line. Chai nafshi, he says. Listen to this amazing line, says Rav Yaakov Emden. Bonani ben iflos eile, godlu etzli, it's like, yoser mikol nisim ben iflos, sh'osa Hashem yizbarach la'avoseinu b'mitzrayim u'b'midbar u'b'eretz Yisrael. The very fact that the Jewish people survives against all odds, says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, is a greater nais than anything that happened in Mitzrayim, at Kriyas Yamsuf, in the Midbar, in Eretz Yisrael, and beyond. The longer the Golus goes, he says, clearly looking for a silver lining, the more true, and the more real this nais is it to him and becomes. As the famous saying goes, like the sheep, surrounded by the pack of wolves. With all the problems, with all the attack, with all the enemies, the Vuchad Netzar, Titus, all the dispersions we spoke about in the Kina from the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, all the enemies that we have now, all the self-inflicted wounds, all the problems, all the division, all the divisiveness, all the machlokas, and yet somehow we're still here. And even better than Rav Yaakov Emden knew, we're in Eretz Yisrael. In a Jewish country with a Jewish government, sovereignty, Chazra Machos Yisrael. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And the fact that we're living it, and especially those of us living it in Eretz Yisrael, we shouldn't take it for granted. And it may be hard, especially on a day like today, but it truly is and should be a Nechama.